You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Ben Norton. Ben Norton is a journalist and writer whose work primarily focuses on U.S. foreign policy, the Middle East, media criticism, and movements for economic and social justice. He lives in New York City, and one of his recent articles at Alternet is called How Trump's CIA Used Bin Laden Files and a Neocon Think Tank to Escalate Tensions with Iran. Ben Norton, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. The CIA, I mean, pre-Trump, the CIA seems to me to have been after Iran since approximately the creation of the CIA. What has changed and what has it done now?
Well, to be frank, actually, it's since 1979. People forget that before 79, before the Iranian Revolution, Iran was a U.S. proxy in the region. The U.S. backed the dictator, the Shah, and it was a close U.S. ally that worked with Israel and Saudi Arabia. It's since 1979, when there was a revolution that overthrew the Western-backed monarch, that things have really shifted. But of course, I mean, in 1953, one of the CIA's, first hurrahs was overthrowing the democratically elected prime minister, Mossadegh, on behalf of oil companies. This raises a really interesting point, and it's an important one that I try to stress in a lot of my work, and that's that regardless of who is in the White House, U.S. foreign policy really stays very similar, whether it's a Democratic or Republican, whether or not they campaign on changing foreign policy. At the end of the day, there is a status quo of imperialism. The U.S. has the largest empire in the world. It has more than 800 foreign military bases. It has 150,000 military personnel in 150 countries. We recently saw the attack in Niger, and people were like, why does the U.S. have troops in Niger? I mean, the U.S. has troops everywhere. But Iran has really been a linchpin for a lot of this. And in particular, Donald Trump, even though every president has opposed the Iranian government since the revolution, Trump has made it a key part of his foreign policy. And in October, he gave an important speech that was all about Iran, and he demonized the country. He, in fact, as I detailed in another article, blamed Iran for al-Qaeda attacks and was, in fact, whitewashing bin Laden and al-Qaeda in an order to try to demonize Iran and blame Tehran for all these incidents. So we've really seen an escalation, and I don't think it's unprecedented, but I think it, compared to Obama, it is certainly an escalation in U.S. aggression against Iran. And the CIA has in particular been a key factor in the new Trump administration's strategy.
And what is the latest maneuver by the CIA?
Well, yeah, I mean, this, of course, isn't necessarily new. Again, so we see these tactics that are used over a period of decades that come back again and again. But now the Trump administration in the past several weeks has absurdly been trying to link Iran to al-Qaeda. And to some Americans, this might not seem strange, but it actually is incredibly bizarre and ridiculous. It is flatly ridiculous. First of all, Iran is a Shia majority country. And of course, it's theocratic. So the Shia theology that its government is based on is in fact directly opposed to al-Qaeda, which is a Sunni extremist Salafi group. And in fact, al-Qaeda, which shares the same ideology as Saudi Arabia, Iran's arch rival, al-Qaeda considers Shia to be non-Muslim apostates. And in fact, many of the people killed by al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other Salafi groups are Shia. They're Muslims, but they're from the Shia sect, which is a small minority that makes up less than 1/5 of all the Muslims throughout the world. So first of all, the attempt to link Iran to al-Qaeda is just preposterous from a political and theological perspective. But even beyond that, the Trump administration's attempts to link Iran to al-Qaeda are ridiculously and dangerously specious when we look at the history of similar attempts. Of course, in the lead-up into the illegal 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration tried without any evidence to link Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi leader to Al-Qaeda. Again, there was no proof of this. There was only one supposed piece of evidence, and that was that an Iraqi intelligence official met an Al-Qaeda member in the Czech Republic, but even that was totally wrong. It was just simply not true. But this is even more extreme. So we see the Trump administration adopting a tactic that was used by the Bush administration to justify invading Iraq. And now we see the CIA encouraging a similar tactic where I detail in my article, we know that the CIA released further documents related to bin Laden, which these documents were obtained during the raid of his compound in Abbottabad in Pakistan. And it's very clear that the CIA released these documents for political reasons. And that has been exposed. I mean, this is not me speculating. These intentions have been exposed by the new director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, who said this expressly last month in October when he was speaking at a conference organized by the neoconservative think tank Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And he said he was asked by this neoconservative think tank apparatchik about the supposed ties between Iran and Al-Qaeda. And the new CIA director, Mike Pompeo, who is a longtime Trump stalwart, he's a close friend of Trump, Pompeo said, well, we have new documents that will be coming out soon detailing these ties. So it's very clear, and I can get more into the nitty-gritty details, but it's very clear that this was a politically motivated release of further bin Laden documents. And the attempt was to supposedly try to link this Sunni extremist group to Iran to justify the very aggressive posturing the Trump administration has been taking.
When I link through Ben Norton to one of these supposed bin Laden documents via this right-wing think tank, I find a document that appears to be in Arabic. And due to my ignorance, I'm incapable of making heads or tails of it. Has anybody with minimal credibility translated these new documents into English?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I read and I studied Arabic at a moderate level, and I've looked through some of them, and they look real. I mean, I certainly do not have the skills needed to verify whether or not documents are fake or not. But I mean, they might be real. But even if they are real, what they expose is not what people are claiming. So, for instance, to provide a little more details about how this clear coordination is working, the CIA gave documents, these bin Laden documents, to the Foundation for Defense of Democracies project, the Long War Journal, which is, again, a neoconservative project that focuses on Iran, whatever U.S. enemy is being demonized this month. And in fact, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, the FDD, they have a very long history of advocating for very aggressive military action against Iran. So the CIA gave this organization and its Long War Journal documents early, before they publicly released all the bin Laden documents, which gave them time to sift through the documents and find the supposed minor links to between Al-Qaeda and Iran. The only things they could come up with, which again, might not even be true, but even if they are, this is not a big deal. The Long War Journal claimed that several Al-Qaeda leaders have lived in Iran, okay? But what they did not stress is the fact that when they were in Iran, they were being detained, okay? So Iran was detaining Al-Qaeda leaders. That actually sounds like something that the U.S. would supposedly want. Another document supposedly shows that a member of the bin Laden family had his wedding in Iran. So these are not like smoking guns. So even if the documents are correct, and I don't have a reason to suspect that they're false, actually, I think we can reasonably suspect that they're true. If these documents are real and what they show is that some Al-Qaeda leaders were detained in Iran, that is not, to me, in any way some kind of scandal. They're grasping for anything they could find to try to make these ridiculous links look like they're significant when they're not.
And yet I'm starting to see headlines and things pop up on social media and on websites alleging Iran being behind 9/11. I mean, it's exactly, people tell me the Pentagon's gone green. I say, yeah, they're recycling 100% of their propaganda. It's exactly what we were told about Iraq. I mean, you would think for the billions of dollars that these agencies have. They could think up a new idea. But if it worked for Iraq, it appears they want to try the same thing again.
No, absolutely. I mean, as for the attempts to link Iran 9/11, I mean, this is just so preposterous. It's hard to wrap my mind around it, especially considering the fact that, one, not only politically and theologically are Iran and Al-Qaeda, you know, this Salafi group opposed, but also Iran strongly opposed the invasion of Iraq. You know, there's been this attempt post facto to rewrite the history and say, oh, Iran wanted the U.S. to invade Iraq, and then Iran, you know, was going to take over Iraq and turn Iraq into a colony, which, you know, the New York Times has been publishing all these articles talking about how Iran's nefarious influence in Iraq is challenging U.S. power. And as examples, they say Iran is selling yogurt and chicken inside Iraq. Oh, my God. Well, I mean, this is just, it's so obscene and it's just outrageous. I mean, it's an example of how we really do not have a free press in this country. The media, you know, the ostensible independent corporate media just largely echoes U.S. government talking points, regardless of how, you know, totally wrong and fallacious they are. But this is, it's just one of the most ridiculous things I can imagine. And the New York Times, in fact, itself, recently issued a retraction. This was this year, after 4 years, claiming that Iran supposedly sponsored 9/11. And a friend of mine, who's a journalist, Adam Johnston, wrote an article for FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, looking at this, at how after 4 years, the New York Times put a small little correction at the bottom of its article where no one would notice it, saying, oh yeah, by the way, Iran had nothing to do with 9/11. So these are very clearly politically motivated claims that have no basis in reality and are only being used to obfuscate and to justify U.S. foreign policy.
So what is the game plan of people who seem to be pushing for war on Iran? The Foundation for Defense of Democracies, apparently, as you report, gets money from Sheldon Adelson. You have Mike Pompeo making ridiculous allegations against Iran. You have the National Security Advisor, McMaster, who calls Trump an idiot but wants Trump to do this idiotic thing. Have they given up now on tearing up the nuclear agreement? Because surely to get a war going with Iran will require something more than this sort of nonsense.
Well, to be frank, I don't think at this moment the U.S. is trying to directly wage war on Iran. It would just be so catastrophic, and everyone knows it. It just can't happen right now. Unfortunately, I think it's certainly not off the table for the future. But, you know, Iran is not even Iraq. Iraq was already a disaster. It killed 1 million people. It destabilized the entire region. It gave birth to ISIS. But Iran is even stronger. Iran has a very strong military and significant allies. And I don't think that the Trump administration, I mean, there are a lot of crazy things that it will do, but it's simply not in the cards at this moment. However, what the U.S. is going to do under Trump is what it's done for years, but intensified. And that is use different proxy conflicts and indirect means to try to weaken and destabilize Iran. So first of all, we need to remember that the U.S. has very harsh sanctions against Iran. And sanctions are, I would argue, a form of war. Of course, they're not the kind of war that we think of when you have bombs falling, but they're a major act of aggression in which the U.S. is applying economic means to harm not just Iran, but the Iranian civilians, the civilian population in the country who do not have access to, you know, many things economically because of these crippling sanctions. And the Trump administration has only continued those sanctions, and in an attempt to try to undermine the Iran nuclear deal, has reimposed more sanctions. And this is, of course, in violation of the agreement, which the Trump administration has repeatedly, reluctantly acknowledged that Iran is following. Iran is in no way the aggressor when it comes to this. Iran, you know, there's a lot of criticism of the Iranian government, but Iran has totally followed the agreement. And it's not just the U.S. and Iran that made this agreement. People forget. It's all of the permanent members of the Security Council, including France, including China, including Russia. I mean, the U.S. under Trump, you know, they think they can just withdraw from this international agreement unilaterally. But that's not how international law works. And it just, again, shows how the U.S. does not care about international law and international norms. It will do whatever it wants to justify its aggressive foreign policy. So I think those are part of it. But then we also see what's going on in neighboring countries. We see, of course, Syria and Iraq, and we see now Lebanon. The most recent development in Lebanon is, in fact, I think one of the most worrying and interesting ones. We saw that the former prime minister of Lebanon, Saad Hariri, he went on a trip. He was called to Saudi Arabia. And in Riyadh, on TV, he resigned in a very bizarre speech that was clearly written by someone else. And he's essentially been held hostage now. So we see Saudi Arabia, a U.S. proxy in the region, destabilizing a democratically elected government in Lebanon. You know, the U.S. always claims, oh, we need to support democracy. They don't care about democracy. Their closest ally and proxy in the region is destabilizing the country of Lebanon, forcing its prime minister to resign, and in many ways destroying its elected government. And we see this, of course, is all justified with the supposed threat of Iran. Saudi Arabia says, we had to do this because Hezbollah has taken over Lebanon, even though Hezbollah, its political wing, has elected members in the parliament in Lebanon. And the U.S. considers Hezbollah a terrorist organization, which is, you know, of course, politically motivated. Hezbollah, unlike extremist groups, Hezbollah does not target civilians. The only reason they considered a terrorist organization is the same reason they considered South African anti-apartheid leaders terrorists. Nelson Mandela was on the terrorist list until 2008. So, you know, there are so many double standards and there's so much hypocrisy, but it's very clear that all of these actions are related to an attempt to undermine Iran. And the U.S. might not be dropping bombs tomorrow, but it's going to use the conflicts in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq. It's going to use politics in the region. It's going to use sanctions to try to weaken the government of Tehran.
And the flip side, Ben Norton, of this U.S. Antagonization of Iran is its partnership and friendship and support for Saudi Arabia, not just in Syria and Lebanon, but also in Yemen, where the U.S. and Saudi governments have been partners in the destruction of a country that is threatening massive death and suffering in the weeks ahead. What is the state of affairs in Yemen?
I'm so glad we're talking about this now, and I'm so glad that there's been some media coverage because, you know, the war in Yemen has been going on for 970 days as of today is November 21st. So this is a conflict that's gone on since March of 2015, and I, in fact, have been reporting on it a lot.
This is after Obama's successful drone war in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. The drone war in Yemen began immediately after 9/11. It even began under Bush. And so that's been going on for 16 years. But in addition to that, since March 2015, Saudi Arabia, with staunch U.S. support, also support from the British, has been waging a brutal bombing campaign, launching thousands of air sorties, more than one third of which have hit civilian areas, and it's killed thousands of civilians. And even worse than that, not only has it killed thousands of civilians, but it has led to the deaths of many tens of thousands more by creating the largest humanitarian catastrophe in the world. So since March 2015, the coalition that is supposedly, it's called led by Saudi Arabia, that's what all the media outlets say, but the U.S. Military is deeply involved. And the New York Times editorial board acknowledged in a rare, you know, editorial on this issue that were it not for American support, that Saudi Arabia would not be able to wage the war. So this is, I would call it a U.S.-Saudi war. It's not just Saudi. And not only have they been brutally bombing Yemen for 2.5 years now, but they also have been imposing a blockade. And Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. Even before the conflict, the majority of the population was food insecure. But now you have millions of people on the verge of famine in what the UN has warned could be the largest famine the world has seen in decades. You know, we live in 2017. We, you know, have this impression that we've defeated famine, we've defeated disease. No, not only is Yemen on the verge of massive famine thanks to this war, in which the U.S. and the U.K. have been deeply involved. Also, it has the largest cholera outbreak in recorded history. And you know, these records began in the mid-20th century, but cholera is an easily preventable disease. And now you have as of this, you know, this month, toward the end of November and early December, we'll probably have 1 million cases of cholera inside Yemen, which, again, to stress this, is easily preventable. But because the health system has been so destroyed by this war, where about 55% of health clinics in Yemen are either not functional or only partially functional, there's been a complete destruction of civil society in the country. For more than a year, health workers have not been paid. I mean, things are just so beyond, you know, like a movie. It's beyond horrifying, horrible. And unfortunately, the U.S., again, is directly involved. The Obama administration did $112 billion in arms sales with Saudi Arabia, and the Trump administration has been doing the same. In fact, Trump visited Saudi Arabia several months ago, and he immediately signed a $110 billion arms deal with the country. So, unfortunately, this issue is not new. It's been going on for 32 months. But fortunately, now there's been some increasing attention to what's happening.
And U.S. military direct involvement, targeting and refueling midair and so forth. I mean, this is a U.S. Saudi military operation, as you noted. What I would love your view on is how we change the U.S. media on this, because I've thought for a long time that if it weren't caused by a U.S.-backed war, there would be a very different sort of media coverage of this crisis. And yet, every once in a while, you see a story, even on the front page of the Washington Post, about how the famines in Yemen and surrounding countries are caused by wars. But then, you know, you go right back to coverage like the recent 60 Minutes coverage that talks about the crisis without mentioning the United States' role at all. And most of the media not even doing that, not even talking about the crisis. How do we change that?
Of course. And unfortunately, it's not just the American media, it's also the British media. We see the same kind of coverage. And, you know, the US and the UK have been deeply involved equally. The UK has also done billions of dollars of arms sales and is providing military assistance. So, I mean, I think there are a few ways to respond to this. One, we have to understand the issue. And I would argue the primary issue right now at this moment is no longer simply covering Yemen, which has been an issue for many months. I mean, I've been reporting on this issue for 2.5 years now. And I remember I was a staff writer at Salon, and I was writing articles very frequently about Yemen, and people would be like, why are you writing so much about Yemen? Like, what's even going on? And now, after 32 months of this war, people are finally seeing why I was so obsessed with it. I mean, this is the largest humanitarian crisis in the world, and the UN has been saying that for a year now. So that was the first issue with media coverage. Fortunately, we've gone over that hurdle, and now we have another issue, which is the way that the issue is presented. So now we do have coverage of Yemen, but like you said, the role of the United States and the United Kingdom is completely either downplayed or erased. 60 Minutes just released a great episode of their, you know, material on the war in Yemen. Of course, it did not one time mention the key role the United States has played in this conflict. The key role, not an accompanying role, the key role. You know, just to emphasize, as you said, and as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. is providing billions of dollars of weapons, and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have documented with video and photos rubble in civilian areas that were bombed by the U.S.-Saudi coalition in Yemen. And all the fragments of the bombs say made in the U.S., made in Britain. But the U.S. military has also been doing in-air refueling, providing millions of gallons of fuel for the Saudi planes. And many of the Saudi planes were also made in the U.S. And the U.S. just did another arms deal selling planes to Saudi Arabia. But not just that. American and British military officers have also physically been in the command room with Saudi bombers. And like you said, they provided a list of targets that this so-called Saudi-led coalition will be attacking. Of course, media outlets will mention this every once in a while, but it is not systematic. So I think one of the things that we have to do, you know, as people working in media, as anti-war activists, others, is pressure media outlets to acknowledge this fundamental reality without which we can't understand what's going on. Because it's one thing to report on an issue, but it's another thing to misreport on the issue. And in some ways, ignoring an issue is actually not as bad in some ways as misrepresenting what's going on. And then beyond that, of course, beyond just looking at the media coverage, we have to look at what our government is doing and look at ways in which we can pressure it to change its policies. And fortunately, there has been some progress in the Congress, although it has not been successful, but there has been progress. There have been several bills that have been introduced in both the House and the Senate over the past about a year and a half. We have some Congress people like Ted Lieu in California, Chris Murphy in the Senate, and even, you know, we have some Republicans who are more anti-war or libertarian-leaning like Rand Paul who have been raising this issue. They still do not have a majority of support in either the House or the Senate. But there is some issue. There is some concern that has been raised, and some people are finally speaking out. And I actually think that this is an issue that should, at least ideally, be easier politically than an issue like Israel-Palestine. You know, people, when it comes to Israel-Palestine, people are smeared and demonized and blacklisted for even acknowledging Israel's violations of international law, the occupation, you go down the list. With Saudi Arabia, it's much harder to defend Saudi Arabia than it is Israel. So I would think that there would be bipartisan political support on this issue. Of course, Saudi Arabia has hired a dozen lobbyists in Washington, D.C. It has, you know, so much money, thanks to its oil revenue, to throw around. But we have seen some breakthrough. It just certainly needs to go much further.
It needs to reverse U.S. policy, not just stop what it's doing now. We have just a couple minutes left, Ben. Is it possible that we can take what little talk there's been in Congress and turn it into better public awareness and cycle that back into greater action in Congress? Or can we get to the Trump administration? How can we actually open up the ports and let in aid and food and stop the destruction, because otherwise we're going to see millions of deaths and people are going to be misinformed about what caused them, and we're not going to get anywhere.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think there's a simple answer to that, but I think the most important answer is we need to rebuild the anti-war movement. You know, unfortunately, I have little faith in Congress, and Congress is only forced to do the right thing at the last possible minute. History shows that again and again and again. You know, Congress did not just willingly sign the Voting Rights Act. It took a massive civil rights movement with huge grassroots support, where people were out in the streets, where they were, you know, organizing campaigns and boycotts. We need to rebuild the anti-war movement, which was destroyed under the Obama administration. You know, people voted in a Democrat and they thought he would change everything. Of course, he changed virtually nothing. So that is
an excellent answer, and I wish we could continue. I agree with you 100%, but we are out of time. Ben Norton's work can be found at alternate.org. We'll put up links at talknationradio.org. Ben, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Of course, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the great show.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, after years of a Saudi-led war, Yemen is in the midst of a humanitarian crisis on a scale hard to comprehend. At least 10,000 dead, looming famine, and now a shocking outbreak of cholera. But U.S. citizens looking to understand the U.S. role in driving the disaster or in potentially easing it get little help from accounts like that of the Washington Post, which told readers, it's a complicated story. Shireen Aladimi, a doctoral candidate and instructor at Harvard University, will join us to talk about what accounts like that are leaving out. Also on the program, listeners know that hard-won net neutrality rules prohibit internet service providers from blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization of internet content, and how important that level playing field has been for everyone, but especially for those who've historically and presently had little voice in major media, including people of color, and for organizers. Former Verizon lawyer, now FCC chair, Ajit Pai, has had those rules in his sights since taking office, and now we're facing a December vote to repeal them. So what now? We'll hear what now from Aaron Shields, National Field Organizer for Internet Rights with the Center for Media Justice. All of that's coming up, but first, a quick look back at recent press. In a world of shocking news, the idea of 21st century slave markets, human beings sold for a few hundred dollars, still stops you in your tracks. CNN published an explosive story in mid-November, terrifying video from Libya that shows young African refugees being auctioned, human beings described as big, strong boys for farm work and sold for as little as $400. As Ben Norton reported for Fair.org, CNN's multimedia story included videos, photos, and a chart, but no mention of NATO or the 2011 war that destroyed Libya's government. In March 2011, NATO launched a war in Libya expressly aimed at toppling the government of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. and its allies flew some 26,000 sorties over the country, launched hundreds of cruise missiles in what was initially presented as a humanitarian intervention, but later acknowledged as being about regime change. In this effort, reminds Norton, NATO supported an array of rebel groups, many of which were dominated by Islamist extremists and harbored violently racist views. Now, 6 years later, Libya is roiled by chaos and bloodshed. Many thousands have died, millions are displaced. But reports like CNN's and the flurry of stories that followed it ignore recent history and present slavery in Libya as an apolitical and timeless human rights issue. One exception was a New York Times editorial that linked the U.S.-backed military operation to the ongoing catastrophe. The April editorial called Libya's slave trading another level of horror and stated, quote, none of this would be possible if not for the political chaos in Libya since the civil war in 2011, when, with the involvement of a NATO coalition that included the United States, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi was toppled. Migrants have become the gold that finances Libya's warring factions. Close quote. That connection is commendable, though it's hard to forget that when NATO launched its war in Libya, the Times editorial board cheered it on. Norton cites Wall Street Journal reporter Sam Dogger and Andrew Gilligan from Britain's Telegraph, who early in the NATO war reported on the abuse of African migrant workers and black Libyans, assumed to be pro-Gaddafi mercenaries. They cited rebel slogans found in the city of Misrata, for example, referring to, quote, the Brigade for Purging Slaves, Black Skin, close quote. The enslavement of African refugees and migrants is indeed a new level of horror. But media who don't acknowledge NATO's and the U.S. role in laying the groundwork are sidestepping a key part of the story. And finally, Counterspin noted the recent death of media critic Ed Herman. The New York Times noted it too. And, like Counterspin, the paper's November 21st obituary included a comment from FAIR founder Jeff Cohen. But it also made a glaring and very Timesian error of just the sort that Ed pointed out. The Times' Sam Roberts wrote of the classic book that Herman co-wrote with Noam Chomsky, quote, "Manufacturing Consent was severely criticized as having soft-pedaled evidence of genocide in Cambodia, Rwanda, and during the Bosnian War, Srebrenica," close quote. Except Manufacturing Consent was published in 1988, years before the 1994 Rwandan genocide or the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. The book does deal at length with the Cambodian mass murders. It cites the work of historian Michael Vickery, who estimated that the Khmer Rouge executed some 200,000 to 300,000 people, with a total of about 750,000 excess deaths out of a population of 7 million due to killings, famine, and disease during their three-year reign. Vickery found that a lesser but comparable figure, about 500,000, were killed in the U.S. bombing of Cambodia beginning in 1969 and the concurrent Cambodian Civil War. The book did not argue that Khmer Rouge's Pol Pot was not guilty of mass murder, but rather that different standards of evidence and vastly different levels of outrage were applied to atrocities committed by the United States compared to those of official enemies, the latter having worthy victims and the former unworthy, in the book's terminology. Herman and Chomsky note that they came under sustained attack for insisting that the same standards be applied to mass violence, regardless of the perpetrators. As they wrote, quote, "Charges against dissident opinion require no evidence, and ideologically useful accusations will stand merely on the basis of endless repetition, no matter how ludicrous they may be," close quote. The New York Times' posthumous accusation that Manufacturing Consent was criticized for downplaying atrocities that happened years after it was published certainly falls in the ludicrous category. But after hearing from FAIR activists, the Times corrected the error. We thank everyone who contacted the paper. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The enormity of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen is staggering. At least 10,000 people have died in the last 2 years of Saudi war in the country, already among the poorest in the region. The UN says Yemen faces the worst famine the world has seen for decades, with at least 7 million people in need of immediate food aid. More than a 500,000 children suffer from severe acute malnutrition, and millions more lack access to any health care at all. This while Yemen faces an outbreak of cholera that's being called possibly the worst in history. Yet Americans have heard little about what's happening in Yemen and still less about how it relates to us. Shireen Aladimi is a doctoral candidate and instructor at Harvard University, working to bring attention to the crisis. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Shireen Aladimi.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it has been noted that U.S. media are doing really very little, particularly television, on the ongoing disaster in Yemen. One outlet that did, CBS's 60 Minutes, reported compellingly and under difficult journalistic conditions about the famine and the bombing victims, and they indicated the Saudis as aggressors. But despite being a U.S. program aimed at a U.S. audience, 60 Minutes said not one word about U.S. involvement, leaving the impression of a regional conflict fitted into this familiar, reductive Sunni versus Shia framework. What would you have Americans understand about this country's role in the Yemen crisis?
Well, thanks for bringing up the CBS report, because that was a huge disappointment. It was this one opportunity for mainstream audience in the U.S. to learn for the first time, perhaps, what is going on in Yemen and what our role is specifically. But it was quickly, like you said, characterized as a Sunni-Shia conflict, which is far from the truth. And not once was it mentioned that the U.S. is in fact very much involved in Yemen and has been from the onset of the war. So when the Saudis decided to attack Yemen in March 2015, the Americans under Obama's administration were right there along with them in the command room, helping them with targeting practice, helping them with logistics and training. The U.S. military refuels Saudi jets midair as they're bombing. And so we have been heavily involved. We've continued to be involved under Trump's administration. And this is, of course, in addition to the billions in weapons sales that have occurred over the past couple of years.
There also is the role that the U.S. plays in sort of shielding Saudi Arabia at the U.N., isn't there?
Exactly. Over and over, the U.N. has failed to really take any decisive stance against Saudi Arabia. In fact, there have been some really outrageous moves. For example, they've been allowed to investigate their own crimes in Yemen. And of course, they come out months later saying that they were cleared. So it's just been an absurd game that they're playing in the UN, and people's lives are at stake here. And we've been shielding them from any independent investigation.
Well, the latest headlines are about an easing of the Saudi blockade with some food and vaccines coming through. But we're told not really to take that as a sign of real easing of the hardship there.
Not at all. So it's trickling in. Whatever aid is coming right now is trickling in. And like you mentioned, 7 million people are in desperate need of that aid. You know, they need it immediately. But then you also have 20 million people who need food, who can't afford what little food remains in the country. And so we don't only need aid coming in, but we need trade. And in fact, we can't be begging the Saudi-led coalition to make these decisions and to hold an entire country hostage and to use starvation as a war tactic. In fact, we should be demanding that they end this intervention in Yemen so that people can go back to their lives and try to rebuild and deal with our internal conflict.
Well, the New York Times had a piece on November 22nd that talked about how this isn't any sort of natural disaster. You know, it used the phrases when food is a weapon, when disease is no accident, and when civilians are targeted. And it even noted, quote, United Nations experts have warned that some of the actions carried out by the warring parties, the Saudi-led coalition and the Iran-backed Houthi rebels, could amount to crimes against humanity because of their systematic and widespread execution, close quote. Still, that seems to me to be at most talking about the U.S. pressing the Saudis and not about U.S. citizens pressing their own lawmakers here.
Exactly. This is presented as an equivalent war between, you know, Saudi Arabia and Iran. And again, it couldn't be further from the truth. There's very little evidence that Iran is involved at all in Yemen. And the way Yemenis see it is that this is very much a U.S.-Saudi war on Yemen with the help of other regional powers. And so to characterize this as something just that's happening over there in a foreign land and we're trying to put an end to it, that's really not the case. We are at the center of this. And if our citizens don't really know our involvement, then there's no hope for us to be politically involved to try to push our elected officials to do something about our role in Yemen.
Well, we have, of course, Donald Trump bragging about $110 billion of arms sales to Saudi Arabia, which the best thing you can say is that he's probably lying about that amount. But at the same time, the House of Representatives, they passed this resolution stating that U.S. military assistance to Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen is not authorized under this, authorization for use of military force, this post-9/11 legislation. Now, it's non-binding. It doesn't actually stop the support, but it does acknowledge the U.S. role. How meaningful do you think that resolution is?
So the problem with that resolution is that it was a compromise resolution. The previous resolution was House Concurrent Resolution 81, which actually called for the U.S. to stop helping Saudi Arabia in any way, shape, or form. And that was proposed by Congressman Ro Khanna in California. Basically, he had invoked the War Powers Resolution, which meant that it had to go to vote and they had to debate it in the House. But it was quickly stripped of its privileged status, and they had to negotiate this compromise bill that was, like you said, non-binding, And yes, it acknowledged that this war is unauthorized, but it doesn't mean anything for U.S. involvement in Yemen. Nothing changes. We continue helping the Saudis without any repercussions.
And am I right that there is nothing in the Senate that's comparable?
There's nothing in the Senate right now. There are a couple of senators who have been vocal against this. So Senator Chris Murphy, for example. We need senators to introduce legislation that would extricate the U.S. from the war on Yemen.
Well, I read some of the comments after your appearance on The Real News, and one of them said, well, yes, you've outlined the suffering in Yemen, but what about the root causes? And what I hear in that is a suggestion that there could be some political or strategic consideration that would somehow make 7 million starving people make sense.
Of course, the U.S. has interests in the region. Yemen is at a strategic location at the Red Sea, and it's at the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. And there's some oil barrels that go through there every day. Not many in the grand scheme of things, but still the U.S. has interest there. And Saudi Arabia, of course, have always wanted to maintain control in Yemen, and they've been involved in Yemen's various wars and, you know, internal politics over the years. But this comes down to this alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States that we refuse to even reconsider, given the tremendous humanitarian impact in Yemen. This is not just, as I think the Saudis had imagined, a war that was going to end in a couple of weeks, where they were going to come bomb and leave and things were going to go back to normal for them. They didn't anticipate that this was going to drag on for 2 years and 8 months now. So we should be reconsidering our help of the Saudis. We're not just selling weapons, like you said. We're so involved in many ways, and every 10 minutes a child is dying. 130 children are dying every single day. 63,000 children died last year. 50,000 more died this year. So the numbers are incredible, and the suffering is just horrendous. At what point do we stop and say, well, maybe we should reconsider this alliance because it's not helping anyone?
Well, to the extent that that 60 Minutes segment referenced a U.S. role, it was by spotlighting the American who heads the U.N.'s World Food Program. So if anything, we're sort of the heroes of the piece. I have a concern that even as headlines come in about people dying, about cholera, that Americans will then talk about the need for the U.S. to take action, you know, as if we weren't taking action now, you know. So to be clear, if the U.S. were to cut off the refueling and the targeting aid and the shielding at the U.N., it would change the situation here.
Absolutely. Yemenis are not asking the U.S. to come and save them from Saudi Arabia. We have to be very clear about that. We're not asking for intervention. We're asking for them to stop this intervention, to remove themselves from this conflict, to stop interfering in the politics of Yemen and to cause this, you know, egregious humanitarian suffering by helping the Saudis at all these levels. And so if the U.S. were to stop, like you said, refueling, shielding the U.N., there are even reports that they're helping impose the blockade. If we stop all of this, then there's no way that the Saudis can continue this war much longer because they're so incredibly dependent on the U.S.'s support.
So if people are looking for something to do right now in response to this information, what would you recommend?
So I'd recommend that people call their senators and their congressmen, email them, visit their local offices, and really urge them to introduce or support legislation like House Concurrent Resolution 81 that really pushes the U.S. to stop its support of the Saudi Arabian in their war against Yemen.
We've been speaking with Shireen Al-Adeimi. Her October article, Only Americans Can Stop America's War on Yemen, can be found on Common Dreams. Shireen Al-Adeimi, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Boston Globe's technology writer says concerns about the FCC's plan to repeal net neutrality are overhyped. Probably what will happen if the agency eliminates the rules that keep the internet a level playing field, as it seems set to do, is not much. In the same column, Tiawatha Bray describes net neutrality as regulatory overkill on a massive scale. So, a massive-scale thing whose elimination will nevertheless not mean much. Should, for example, a company like Comcast block access to, say, Amazon Prime Video, so subscribers have to use Comcast service, Bray says millions of angry customers would just switch to a rival service. So your head's already well scratched before Bray gets to the presumably ingenuous question, quote, what internet company would put itself in the crosshairs of public outrage just to gain a slight and temporary advantage over a rival? Close quote. Well, you may chuckle, but this is the level of arguments in support of the FCC's effort to repeal net neutrality rules. The truth is, advocates have everything on our side. Public opinion, legal precedent, actual understanding of how the internet works. What opponents have, though, is corporate power and its government supporters. So what now? Joining us to discuss where we are in this critical fight is Aaron Shields, National Field Organizer for Internet Rights at the Center for Media Justice, one of the frontline groups on the issue. Welcome to Counterspin, Aaron Shields.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I suspect Counterspin listeners have a healthy mistrust of media corporations claiming that they would never go against the public interest for a silly little thing like profit, you know, but some might be persuaded that the effect of a repeal just might not be so bad or might not mean so much. You bring people to Capitol Hill to talk with lawmakers. What sorts of concerns do they have? What kinds of stories do they tell?
So a lot of my work is bringing people from the field who are doing work with media, organizing and movements, working in their communities to talk about what a net neutrality repeal would mean for them personally. And what you hear over and over again, this underlying issue around being able to control your own narrative. There are a lot of other things that a net neutrality repeal would impact, such as people's access to online education or to health information online. A lot of people in low-income communities and communities of color access education through the internet or doing their homework through the internet. But also on a larger social scale, the internet has been critical to getting around larger media corporations' control of our narratives. And so a lot of times when we're talking with lawmakers and decision makers, what we're emphasizing is the internet's impact on our communities being able to tell our own stories. I'm thinking about Black Lives Matter and Standing Rock and a lot of the work that was being done by ADAPT up on Capitol Hill to stop the repeal of the ACA. A lot of that was powered by the internet and our ability to push back on these dominant narratives that are often pushed in mainstream media. And in these mainstream media arenas, oftentimes we're not even invited to the table. And so it's critical for us to be able to use blogs and Twitter and Facebook to share information, to talk about what's really happening on the ground. And I think that will be a massive blow to social movements moving forward if our voices aren't able to be blocked and censored in those ways.
Well, it seems as though, you know, the FCC has three Republicans and two Democrats, and they often vote along party lines. And so it seems as though this move to repeal may go through in this December vote. But that's not the end of it. What would happen? What happens then?
We're anticipating, as much as we hate to discuss it, that the repeal will happen. But what's next is likely many organizations like Center for Media Justice and EFF will take the FCC to court. And we feel like we have a great chance at winning because we've won in the past. I think you were touching on it earlier. The 2015 open internet rules have been upheld twice in court. And we believe that based on what we've seen, the orders that we've seen come out of the FCC around this repeal, that they don't have a very good standing if we were to challenge this in court. But on the other side of that, there's moves to pressure lawmakers to, you know, introduce some sort of net neutrality legislation. And while that may seem good on the surface level, what we're concerned about is, I mean, as everyone, I'm sure your listeners know, the state of this Congress is not hospitable to a net neutrality order that would keep the 2015 open internet rules as the floor. of course there are going to be, you know, ISP lobbyists in the room when that bill is being made. And so what we're asking congressional members to do now is to speak out publicly against this repeal and for the rules that we already have, and to demand that Chairman Tai do his job and enforce the rules that have been upheld by court that were come to in a democratic way, millions of comments submitted supporting these rules, and to not be beholden to his prior employer and to these four ISP companies who would benefit most from this repeal. So there's still a battle to be had, and we don't want to lose organizing energy. We don't want people to, you know, take their ball and go home. After the repeal, there's a lot that we can be doing to pressure Congress into standing publicly for the 2015 rules. And if there is any legislation put forward, to make sure that it codifies the 2015 open internet rules and nothing less. We actually can't take anything less than that.
Well, so not that we are giving up on other channels, like contacting legislators, like contacting the FCC. All of that is necessary. But I know that we're also talking about going back to the street again, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. We're planning on December 14th, the day of the vote, to have a massive rally in order to keep the energy up around this issue right outside of the FCC. We really don't want Chairman Tai to be able to repeal this without there being some sort of visible pushback and letting him know who exactly is going to be impacted by this repeal. I mean, I think a lot of times people think net neutrality is like this fight between internet companies. And it's really important for us, for CMJ in particular, to say, actually, hold on, you know, the repeal of these is not just going to cost more for Netflix, but it'll actually cost more for our communities, the ways that we're able to talk with each other, to organize, to access job opportunities, to access education. This has a real human impact, not just an impact on a corporation's bottom line. And so I think that's why you'll see in the coming weeks a number of demonstrations, actions, and really disruptions to business as usual, because we really can't let this repeal happen without letting our communities, the media, general public writ large know that we disagree, and that we disagree staunchly.
We've been speaking with Erin Shields. She's National Field Organizer for Internet Rights at the Center for Media Justice. They are online at mediajustice.org. Erin Shields, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Has your doctor talked to you about climate change? If that sounds strange, you need this program, because climate change is the new tobacco. I'll be talking with emergency physician Jay Lemery from Colorado about his new book, Enviro Medics. Then we're off to the UK, where Nicola Wheeler from the famous medical journal The Lancet explains their Climate Countdown 2017 and how doctors are getting involved. But first, the granddaddy of climate change science, Dr. James Hansen, recorded at the COP23 climate conference recently in Bonn, Germany.
Hello, and thank you for coming to another Climate Matters press conference. I'm the executive director of the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. My name's Stuart Scott, and I'm the host of these programs. And we're coming to you live from Bonn, Germany, COP23. I like to give my email address at the beginning and end of each show so that people can write me afterwards with any questions or comments. Now, today's guests with me are three: Dr. James Hansen, former director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, currently the director of Climate Science Awareness and Solutions Program at Columbia University's Earth Institute, and Pam Pearson, founder and director of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative. On my right, Dr. Philip Duffy, who's the president and executive director of the Woods Hole Research Center in Massachusetts. He's also former senior advisor to the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Today's show we're calling Scientific Reticence, A Threat to Humanity and Nature. Dr. Hansen, would you start us off?
Yeah, that title, I think, is directed to my fellow scientists and also to the negotiators at this climate conference and to the public. Richard Feynman, who I would say is the second greatest physicist of the 20th century, liked to poke fun at his fellow physicists about, I'm not sure he used the word reticence, but there was this famous Millikan's oil drop experiment, which was designed to measure the electron charge. And it got an answer which we now know was not quite right because he didn't have the right viscosity of air in the calculation. But his fellow scientists, as they did their experiments, and we're getting a different answer than Millikan, just moved the value a little bit away from Millikan's, and then they would move it a little further and a little further. And after enough years, they finally got to the right answer. But there is a reticence to challenge the expert number. I use this as an example. In 2005, in 2007, when I heard from glaciologists, you know, they were beginning to get really worried about the stability of the ice sheets and the threat that they posed to sea level. And yet, you didn't hear that in public. And the IPCC documents had little, if any, contribution from the ice sheets. So I wrote an article about that. But the problem is we don't have decades to come to the right answer. We need to understand that. So, you know, we now know that the temperature rise of the past few decades has raised global temperature far above the prior level in the Holocene, the last 11,000 years during which civilization developed. And in fact, the temperature now is comparable to the maximum temperature in the Eemian, 120,000 years ago, when sea level was 6 to 9 meters higher. Now, the temperature over the last 50 years has been rising almost linearly, and that's brought us to this high level, well above prior Holocene temperatures. Why has it increased almost linearly? The planet is out of energy balance. There's more energy coming in than going out as heat radiation. Because the increasing greenhouse gases are like a blanket, they reduce the heat radiation to space. And the warming would then bring the planet back to energy balance, except we keep adding more gases to the atmosphere at a rate indicated in this chart of about 0.04 watts per meter squared per year. And that has been more or less constant for the last several decades. Now, IPCC has added to their scenarios RCP 2.6, which is designed to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And based on what I showed you already about how warm the planet has already become relative to the Eemian, we really need at most to have global warming of 1.5 degrees. But what's happening is this has no relation to reality. The reality is that climate forcings are not only continuing to increase, but even increase faster. So there's a gap already between the real world and the 1.5 degree scenario. Well, we could do something about that gap. We could say, okay, let's suck some CO2 out of the atmosphere. Well, with the estimated cost of $150 to $350 per ton, at the low end of that range, you're talking about $600 billion to remove the excess of just 1 year's emissions. Or if it's $350 a ton, it's $1.4 trillion. Now, you can compare that, just if you don't know what $1 trillion is, the global military budget is one last 2015 was $1.7 trillion. The United States military budget, $600 billion. We're not going to spend $1 trillion every year to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. So what we're doing instead is handing young people a situation that's beginning to run out of control. And we have to recognize, you know, scientists are trained to understand, to analyze complex problems. And as we look at this problem, we need to look at the whole picture and make sure that the negotiators and the public understand the situation. The Kyoto Protocol in 1997 was intended to reduce emissions, but you see that even the developed world, the mature economies, all that happened is their emissions have flattened out. And that happened already by 1980, they had flattened out. Kyoto Protocol, where you have each country has a goal, 195 different goals, simply is not effective. And you can see what's happening in the real world. This 1.5 degree scenario requires that emissions be decreased rapidly. It's the equivalent of 3% per year decrease in emissions, plus extracting some CO2 from the air with improved agricultural and forestry practices. And this is simply not happening. The fundamental thing is, and on our recent papers, I have economists as co-authors. It's well understood that as long as fossil fuels remain cheap, we're not going to phase them out. And each country saying, well, we'll try to do better. And we'll maybe increase our targets next year or next decade or two decades downstream. That simply has no effect. We've proven that with the Kyoto Protocol. What you have to do is make the price of fossil fuels include their cost to society. That includes air pollution, water pollution, climate change. And if you do that, then we can move to alternatives like renewable energies, energy efficiency, nuclear power. Let everything compete. But as long as we don't make fossil fuels pay their cost to society, we're not going to solve the problem. And so we can't pretend that we're doing that. And we can see that the scientists should be standing up, and, in my opinion, and telling the public and telling negotiators, you know, you have to do something that actually has an impact.
So the reticence is really that scientists are not going out of there strictly informational, and they're not telling what their gut feel is?
I think that's right, that the scientists who have looked at this whole problem have got to look at the data. I mean, that's what science is, a case of looking at data and explaining the data. Your theories have to fit the data. And the theory that you can solve this problem without a rising price on carbon has no foundation whatever.
And here are a couple of snippets of the talk given at that same conference by Pam Peterson, the founder and director of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative.
The cryosphere has been called a canary in a coal mine, but it is becoming a driver of climate very, very rapidly, and in many ways an irreversible driver of climate. Regional and seasonal temperatures, for example, the Arctic, although we're looking at, say, a global mean temperature of 2 degrees, in the summer, the Arctic is projected to be at about 9 degrees, and in the winter months, 12 degrees C over current temperatures.
And 12C equates to what, about 20C?
Exactly.
20 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, yeah, Fahrenheit. So, in other words, the winter temperatures are rising higher than the summer temperatures, which are rising much higher than global mean temperature.
I remember it was raining in the Arctic on New Year's Day a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going very, very quickly there. And at times, unfortunately, when the cold air is down over the middle latitudes, giving a false sense that, you know, things maybe aren't that bad, when it's actually that the heat is being displaced, in a sense, up to the Arctic. So overshoot scenarios, as are being discussed, hold much greater risk. And the other issue is that 2100 is, in many ways, a very misleading goal. A lot of the data that you see stops in 2100, but for sea level rise in particular, that is just the beginning. And the worst is that it is locked in.
That's all the time that we can play from that 24-minute press conference, and I'll tell you how to find out more in just a minute. Stuart Scott faithfully gathers the bright lights at every major climate conference. He's from the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. This press conference was in Bonn, Germany, live from the COP23 conference. Find a link to the full 24-minute thing in my show blog at ecoshock.org or visit upfsi.org, upfsi.org, for more videos. Look for Climate Matters TV. Now, let the doctors speak. Imagine getting a diagnosis of cancer, but your doctor doesn't tell you cigarettes are causing it and you should quit. Those days are over. Doctors spoke out about tobacco, but every year millions of people get sicker or die because of climate change. Where are the doctors saying climate change is a major illness? That is one of the many important questions asked by Drs. Jay Lemery from the University of Colorado School of Medicine and Paul Orbach from the Stanford School of Medicine. They just released an important new book, Enviromedics: The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. Jay Lemery, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be here.
Your co-author, Paul Orbach, literally wrote the book on wilderness medicine. In fact, a seventh edition textbook on that just came out this year, I see. How did you two connect?
So I was a member of the Wilderness Medical Society early in my career. I finished residency about 2004. And I met Paul through our mutual connection with the WMS. And then actually, I went on a trek with Paul to visit some friends who were doing work at the Everest Base Camp Medical Clinic. So we trekked up in Nepal, and we were on the road, you know, on the trail together for about 2 to 3 weeks. So we became good friends and then really started to shortly thereafter talk about these issues. And, you know, honestly, we started talking about the conspicuous absence of healthcare providers in the larger conversations of climate change and health.
Yeah, it's a huge field. Just the table of contents of your new book, Enviromedics, seems daunting. There's so many impacts. I mean, there's obvious things like heat stroke, but then there's the strange illnesses from insects and algae. How did you two manage to sort out those threats and prioritize them for the book?
Yeah, I mean, so what we really wanted to do is kind of take the conversation to the bedside and talk to people from a clinician's point of view. And so we took the best evidence that's out there. And in some ways, the book is an inventory of what the most likely impacts of climate change on health are. And we wanted to clarify, dispel myths, and then actually talk about what it really is like for a human to have these ailments. And I think that's the clinical voice we wanted to use, because I think science hasn't done a very good job of clarifying exactly what the risks are. You know, often things are couched in public health terms. So talking about, you know, huge populations, 100,000 people, often it's couched in altruism, you know, save the polar bears, love Mother Earth, or abstractions, you know, 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. You know, what does that mean for most people? So we really kind of wanted to go, for lack of a better term, brass tacks and say, look, this is an asthma exacerbation. This is what it feels like. This is how climate change triggers it, or can be a factor in triggering it. and really kind of, again, sort of bring people and give a visceral sense of the illnesses and the pathology that's at stake.
Well, you're an emergency clinician. Do you actually see cases that you would say that climate change is a factor, even in Colorado?
Well, we know, right? We know that extreme heat and extreme weather are all threat multipliers for disease and illness. I mean, that's what we cover in the book. So what we did is Paul's emergency physician as well, we put together composite patients from our career and say, you know, this is what we're talking about. This is what, you know, shortness of breath from degraded air quality on a hot day looks like, you know, an asthma exacerbation or someone with devastating diarrheal illness from an extreme weather event and flooding event, things like that. So, you know, there was no particular patient that we cited, but we put together composite patients based on our understanding of these risks and the pathology that we see every day in emergency departments.
You know, we just had a whole wave of wildfires here in the West, and I had friends, seniors, that just couldn't go outside for most of the summer, and a couple of those ended up in the emergency ward.
Yeah, I mean, there's the thing about climate change is it's really a disease of vulnerability, right? So it's people that, you know, the very young, the very old, people that are sick, socioeconomic vulnerabilities, those are the ones that are going to be bearing the brunt of this. Worldwide, it's going to be places that have very poor infrastructure, poor governance, places with lots of poverty that are going to be disproportionately affected. And this is where a lot of the research is now coming out, is that when you have big wildfires and air quality is degraded over huge swaths of the North American continent, for instance, you know, people are going to suffer. And particularly those that have pre-existing lung disease, who we call it, they have, you know, tenuous physiology already, they're the ones that are going to end up being the most susceptible to illness and the ones that are ultimately going to be showing up in the emergency departments.
And I'm thinking of people in Malaysia, too, when the big fires in Indonesia are blowing smoke over most of East Asia for periods. I'll be talking with other experts about heat deaths, but I wanted to zero in on one of the chapters in your book. It's about vector-borne diseases. And are we talking about Zika? Are we talking about dengue fever or what?
Yeah, so, you know, when you think about that, we think about mosquitoes and ticks. And what we know is happening is that we're making environments more hospitable for the spread of these diseases. And then the way to think about this is that we know that mosquitoes are now increasing their range and their ability to thrive in places of higher latitude. So in the northern hemisphere, they're moving more northerly and higher altitude. For instance, the East African highlands, you know, we know there's data to support that mosquitoes and the diseases that they bring are now encroaching on populations that had historically been naive to diseases like malaria. And so these mosquitoes have warmer temperatures. They are able to have more life cycles within a certain season and are able to proliferate their diseases much more effectively. There might be some variations with this, but again, the larger trends are that these tropical and subtropical diseases are now hitting more and more people. So not only more people, but people that have historically been naive to these diseases. And that brings other problems too, because again, populations are not necessarily, they don't have immunity built up and they don't necessarily have the infrastructure or the behavior adaptations as people that have lived with it their entire lives. So it's basically we're seeing more susceptible populations to these diseases.
I was surprised to see a chapter on algae in your book. I didn't realize that that was totally climate related. What's that about?
Well, harmful algae blooms are a couple things. One, we have warmer water temperatures, which allow algae to thrive in places that maybe they historically haven't. And then you have extreme precipitation events. And what that can do is it can mobilize nutrient runoff. And that's maybe a little bit separate from climate change, but it's all sort of related in sort of our ecosystem use. And so you can imagine a big rainstorm hitting in the upper Midwest, for instance, and then huge amounts of runoff from agricultural nutrients dump into, say, Lake Erie. Warmer temperatures all combine to allow algae to basically have a big party and proliferate. You have what's called a harmful algae bloom. Not only does it devastate the local ecosystem, but through this, we know we have some of the scariest toxins ever known to humans. I mean, there's scary things like amnestic shellfish poisoning, which sounds like a soap opera plot, but it's really, you know, it's devastating. It's like a stroke where you can get affected and it can affect certain parts of your brain where you have memory problems moving forward, neurotoxins, liver toxins from these. And, you know, these aren't things that affect, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, but man, when these happen, you know, the scores of people that are affected, you know, are devastating illnesses. And again, we're seeing more of them encroach in places that have historically been immune because they've been colder areas. Now we're seeing tropical and subtropical diseases affecting more northern, at least in the northern hemisphere, more northern climates.
I'm starting to hear a lot more talk about the mental health impacts of climate change, and I was pleased to see you've got a chapter on that in your book. And I don't think, personally, I don't think that it's limited to people who are actually traumatized by a superstorm or a flood. You don't have to be in it. I think others get discouraged or worried just by the weather news that they see popping up all over the world and the threats of a more dangerous future. What do you think?
You know, they're existential. It's hard to get your hands around. It's hard for one person to feel empowered to change it. It almost seems inevitable or fatalistic in the sense that we're sort of doing a slow march off a cliff. That's what a lot of the news focuses on. And I think you're right. I think it's very scary, but I also think we have plenty of time to change. It doesn't take that much. It just, you know, what we hope to do with the book is really just change our risk assessment. If people understand that the risks affect the health of their loved ones and their children and themselves, then they can go into conversations with a little bit more knowledge. And then you'll go back to their own constituencies, whether they be liberal or conservative, and say, hey, you know what? We've got to change the way we do business in a thoughtful way, but at least they have a better sense of the risk. You know, unfortunately, right now, there's way too many people, certainly in the United States, who just don't think that this is our own fault, right? So if half the people in the room don't think there's a problem, you just have no chance of solving the problem. That was really the point of our book, is to, again, frame it in terms of health risk so people could easily understand it and then move forward to solutions.
Well, even the hospitals that we count on are kind of targets. I mean, we've seen hospitals just this year that were emptied out due to flooding, due to wildfires, or the power goes off, as happened in Puerto Rico. What do hospitals have to do to prepare and adapt to climate change?
Yeah, right. You know, excellent point. You know, one of the things we talk about is that even in the most resource-rich places in the United States, you think of New York and Superstorm Sandy, it was an extreme precipitation event that led to storm surge in the East River that took Bellevue Hospital and NYU Tisch Hospital offline. Those are places I actually trained there. And they were, parts of the hospitals were offline for the better part of a year. That can be devastating to a community, particularly Bellevue's mission to take care of the homeless and the prisoners and the immigrants. You know, these are very vulnerable populations that lose their primary healthcare system or, you know, big disruptions in it. So hospitals, all infrastructure can be very vulnerable. And you ask how to prepare for it. I mean, it's difficult, right? Because we're seeing things now that we've never seen before, historical anomalies happening in terms of weather. You know, this was something we talk a lot about, is the heat wave in 2003 in Paris. You know, I think 12,000 people perished. And again, climate change wasn't the sole cause, but it was certainly a contributor. And perhaps the better lesson is to say, we'll be seeing a lot more of these historical anomalies in the future. And the lessons learned are, you know, we're just going to have to be more heads up and prepared for weather and extreme events that we just haven't had in a particular geographic area.
Yeah, that whole French and European heat wave was just an amazing thing for all of us to see. Developed countries have so many deaths. And I recall news of hospitals in Pakistan filling up this year during a super heat wave. And I wonder, are our emergency wards even beginning to be prepared for that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think most people don't get it, frankly, sadly. I think we're very slow to understand that this is a big risk factor in terms of preparedness. You know, some of the big insurance companies are starting to get there. And remember, these are companies that have to justify to their clients why they're charging more. They're incorporating climate models into their risk assessments. So the market is beginning to support this, these risk assessments. But I think in terms of healthcare, the conversations aren't there yet. And I think we're starting to turn the corner on that one. But really, as of today, there's still a lot of work to be done.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith from the University of Colorado. My guest is Dr. Jay Lemery. We're covering his new book, Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. And I've heard you ask, Jay, where are the clinicians saying there's a conspicuous absence of healthcare providers going public on climate, on clean air, and all that? How can we change, say, medical education to bring up climate-aware doctors? That's what we need now.
Yeah, it's something we've spent a lot of time on. You know, the medical school curriculum is extremely crowded, right? There's just so much that needs to be learned in med school. But what we're trying to do is create easy ways for climate and health issues to be plugged in. We have a textbook. I have a textbook separate from this book on the topic with a full curriculum and, you know, making it very easy for young professors to sort of pick up this topic and interject it. I think what's really most encouraging, though, is that the students really want this. The old guard, as I say, which I'm slowly becoming one of them, we're somewhat ossified in the way we do business, but it's the students who are looking around and seeing the headlines and saying, why aren't we learning more about this? So when we actually have in our school at the University of Colorado sessions on climate and health, I mean, they're packed and the students can't get enough of it, which is encouraging. But I think we have to scale that up, obviously, and make sure that we're getting this into medical education throughout the world, because it's so important to have clinicians who are facile and fluent on these issues and to give some context, you know, not just for their patients, but also for their organizations and colleges. And really, you know, doctors still have a lot of power within their own constituencies to influence opinion. And I think that's something that we talk a lot about is, you know, don't think of yourself as a pediatrician or an ER doc or an internist. Think of yourself as a physician wearing the white coat, because you have a lot of influence, and that's a very powerful fulcrum to affect change.
Well, yeah, you have brought up the example of Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, who told world leaders that a nuclear war is not treatable. I mean, it's a catastrophe well beyond any response. Talk to us about the similarities of that to where we are now with climate change.
Right, excellent. So, you know, it was when you think about the Cold War, and it was in the early 80s when the doctrine got tweaked to the Cold War rhetoric, rather, that was nuclear wars are winnable, right? Very scary. And it was the physicians from both sides of the Iron Curtain that got together and said, hang on, hang on. Nuclear war is the final epidemic with no meaningful cure. Very powerful. And it was unimpeachable. They it came in from a healthcare perspective. And because of that, you know, they had a very powerful voice that resonated and, you know, was attributed to contributing to the demise of the Cold War. I think we're in a similar place. I think when you think about, you know, nuclear Armageddon, right? It's scary. It's politicized. It's existential. It's very difficult to understand how one individual can affect change. But I think we're looking at a very similar opportunity. And I think if you frame it from a healthcare perspective, then it's something people can really wrap their hands around, understand the risks, and you know, move forward to affect change. You know, I think the parallels are very important to see that, because it was successful in many ways, and I think it's important to have some success stories that, you know, we can look at to say, hey, you know, this is not inevitable. We can still change things.
And I totally agree. And so now we need maybe International Physicians for the Prevention of Climate Change. Is the medical profession organizing in the United States and around the world?
There's some. I mean, there's Physicians for Social Responsibility that are doing, you know, incredible work in this sector. There's Healthcare Without Harm, which is a group that says, hey, let's get our own house in order. You know, healthcare, at least in the United States, being 18% of GDP, saying, hey, we're a huge chunk of the economy that's incredibly wasteful. I mean, I know that just from working in hospitals. And then there's something called the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health. And that is a effort out of led by friends at George Mason University who are trying to get the different colleges, so obstetrics and gynecology, pediatrics, even sports medicine, emergency medicine, around the table and say, hey, we're all the colleges for these physicians' specialties. Let's start to come together and focus on climate and health. And we've had a very positive start to that. It's only about a year old. So we're getting there. I think it's a question of infiltrating the mainstream. I think that that's where we are now, as opposed to saying, you know, individual physicians self-selecting and coming together in a separate society. I think we have to bring this messaging into the mainstream medical education, and then after that into the mainstream colleges, which is how physicians are organized.
When a doctor, Jay, sees people made sicker or even dying, maybe partly due to climate change, is it radical or is it part of the Hippocratic Oath to become a climate activist as well?
I mean, it's an excellent question, right? I think any care provider needs to look around at the drivers of disease. And that's really where we come in, is to say, hey, look, we know sickness. This is sickness. The data may be incomplete, but then again, all data in science and medicine is incomplete, but you do your best. When you see a problem, you look at it face value and you begin to affect reasonable change. If the data changes, then medicine changes, but we're just not seeing that yet, and I don't think we will with climate change. I think the data every year is getting more precise and is reinforcing what we already know. And because of that, I think every care provider has to look at the data and say, look, this is a driver of disease, and it will be a major driver in very significant ways for many, many decades. And because of that, then I think it's important for us to have a reasonable conversation, you know, as healthcare providers, and then, you know, do what we do, which is to present the best data and let the policymakers move forward, but with a very clear voice from the healthcare community that this is just dangerous to our health.
But you never know what other people's political or even religious beliefs might be. Is it a little awkward for doctors and patients to talk about climate change as part of their health?
Right. So I think for doctors to talk about it, no. I mean, because that's what we do. We talk about health. Now, you know, when we start to frame it as in politics or religion, I would actually say that I don't really care what one's politics or religion is, because just like if you have risk factors for heart disease, that has really no part of the conversation when we are, you know, we're making diagnosis and treatment plans. So I think it's the same thing in that regard.
You know, we started out talking about your roots in wilderness medicine, and I meant to ask you, do you think that wilderness medicine could help in a chaotic situation like Puerto Rico or maybe the earthquake in Haiti?
Of course. Yeah. So, you know, there's a whole field of humanitarian response and disaster training and disaster management. And so those fields they're relatively new, but there's some real, the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of momentum in the development of those fields. Wilderness medicine, certainly, there's tons of providers who are trained in wilderness medicine. It's just basically how do you take care of people in remote and austere places. And so that expertise absolutely plugs into humanitarian disaster response. And there's a lot of people who have overlap in those two fields. In fact, a lot of colleagues I know have been down in the Caribbean working as DMAT teams or in public health efforts to better characterize and understand, you know, the vulnerabilities that have happened in the Caribbean.
Should we just leave it to the doctors? Should we all learn a little bit about how to, you know, patch up a broken bone so you can make it back out, or how to maybe use some of those herbs that are growing right around you?
You know, I think there's always a good, in fact, we have lots of people who take our courses who are lay people, you know, a weekend courses in wilderness first aid. Those are great things for families going out camping into the backcountry to keep themselves and their families safe. And they're good skills to have for just disaster resiliency, right? That we know, FEMA often talks about having a disaster pack in your home. I mean, those are all good ideas. So I would always encourage people that are interested. You know, there's tons of courses online from many different providers, and we certainly do a lot in Colorado.
I was trying to figure out the public for your book, EnviroMedics. Do you see it as a textbook for university students and doctors, or is it open enough for all of our listeners to get something from it?
Yeah, we wrote it for all listeners. It's written for lay people. We did a basic inventory of the best science that's out there, you know, in terms of how climate change is affecting health, and then we put in clinical vignettes. So we could really share with you what it feels like to take care of these pathologies. And the point is that we'll be seeing a lot more of these pathologies with the way we're headed. So it's not a textbook. It's an easy read. And we wanted to make it very accessible. And for those that are interested, you know, we have other textbooks available for universities and medical school and public health schools.
Yeah. What's the title of your new textbook?
So it's actually, you know, it's a couple years old. It's called Global Climate Change and Human Health from Science to Practice. It's available through Josie Bass, who's a big public health publisher out of San Francisco.
Well, I know that Nick Watts from the prestigious medical journal The Lancet highly recommends your new book, Enviromedics, and I'll be talking with Nick soon. He was off at the Bonn climate talks and said, can we wait till after that? So I'm looking forward to that talk. It does sound like there's at least a wave of climate awareness emerging out of the medical community, and I think that's a really hopeful sign.
Yeah, I mean, Nick and Hugh Montgomery and the Lancet folks have been truly leading the charge on this, at least in the academic field. They're way ahead of the game, and you know, the Lancet Countdown is an outstanding resource and very well done and meticulously, you know, annotated with the best science that's available. So I'd encourage anyone who's interested to look at the Lancet Countdown and the work that they're doing. But yeah, I mean, I think we're starting to see movement in that direction. There's just a ton of work to be done, and you know, the vast majority of healthcare providers are still, you know, they're uncertain and not educated on this. And, you know, the same with vast swaths of the public. And I think if, you know, from where I sit is if we can get healthcare providers to weigh in on the best science, then we can change our risk assessment. And then we can have meaningful policy. Look, I understand, you know, there's energy policy is important. People have jobs tied up in them. That's all totally understood. You know, from my point of view, it's, we have to just understand the risks. If you don't understand the risks, then, you know, then we're all kind of flying in the blind and can't have meaningful conversations. So that's the goal of this book, is just to change the conversation.
We have been talking with Dr. Jay Lemry, the emergency specialist and wilderness medicine expert from the University of Colorado School of Medicine, with co-author Dr. Paul Auerbach from Stanford. He's just published a necessary new book titled Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. I will put links to it in my blog at ecoshock.org, and you can find a lot more at the book website at www.enviromedics.org. Jay Lemry, thank you so much for being our climate emergency doctor here on Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Nick Watts from The Lancet agreed to an interview for Radio EcoShock, but he was away at the Bonn Climate Talks. I tried to nab him right after, but got an email back saying Nick was now in remote Nepal with no phone connection. He recommended the Climate Countdown Program Officer, Nicola Wheeler, and here she comes.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Has your doctor talked to you about the health risk of climate change? According to one of the world's leading medical journals, she or he should. It's all in a big new report called The Lancet Countdown 2017. The British-based publication The Lancet has organized a global body of doctors, scientists, and public policy experts to calculate Where we are now on the road to either climate tragedy or survival. From the University College London, we've reached the Lancet Countdown Project Officer, Nicola Wheeler. Nicola, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Well, of course, to let listeners know why this matters, we do have to begin with at least one dire projection from the 2017 report. Could you give us a snapshot of increasing heat?
Yeah, of course. So one of the indicators that we look at is exposure to heat wave among vulnerable populations. That's people over 65 years old who are especially vulnerable to the health effects of heat waves. And what we find is that already since the year 2000, 125 million additional people are being exposed to heat waves. And in 2015 alone, this was 175 million additional vulnerable people that were exposed to heat waves just in 2015 alone.
That's hundreds of millions of people exposed to heat waves more than previously. What did the Lancet project find out about the loss of labor productivity?
Yeah, so we looked at rural populations that were exposed to changing temperatures. And between 2000 and 2016, we found that people's capacity to do labor and to do labor activities productively had decreased by 5.3% just in those 16 years.
Sometimes factories have to shut down due to heat and other factors. What about the lost productivity in manufacturing and other sectors? Is something being done to gather that data?
Yeah, it's a really good point, and it's something that we really are looking to capture next year. We're already developing our 2018 indicators, looking at how we can improve our existing ones, and even any new indicators to capture information that we haven't yet presented in 2017. And in terms of labour capacity, things like that, like manufacturing, building work, that's all something that we're hoping to build into the report next year.
I was struck by the doctor's view of climate change as a medical issue. Despite the continuing work by The Lancet, we have not heard enough about this. Most of us are not yet hearing it from our doctors. Why not?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And we are increasingly hearing from doctors about the risks of climate change to our health. But you're right, it's not enough yet. That's kind of why this project is so important, is improving our understanding of how climate change is affecting our health and enabling doctors to bring that information to their patients. You know, doctors are a really powerful advocate for health issues. I mean, tobacco is a brilliant example of that. But ultimately, they need really good, solid evidence in order to back the agenda and to explain to patients and to policymakers why climate change matters and why it matters to our health.
Well, it's almost like tobacco. I mean, people are dying about it, so we need to talk about it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Before we go further, what is The Lancet and why is the medical community reporting on climate change?
Sure. So The Lancet is the world's leading independent general medical journal. It aims to improve physicians' clinical practice and their knowledge by bringing novel and innovative research on medical issues directly to physicians. So if you go to any kind of hospital, any doctor's office, they will have a copy of The Lancet in there. So it's a fantastic way to get directly to doctors and to explain these issues to them. In terms of why The Lancet is interested in climate change, it's recognized for a while now the kind of huge threats that climate change poses to human health. But also conversely, that if we address climate change, the opportunities that has for improving health globally. So it's been doing this for quite a few years, like I say. It launched its first kind of detailed research project into health and climate change back in 2009. And since then, it's just been building and building on this agenda. And that's where we've landed now with the Lancet Countdown, where the Lancet is now supporting us to every year report on these health and climate change indicators to really build on that evidence year on year.
When was the Lancet founded?
It was founded back in the 1800s. So it's been around for a couple of hundred years now.
Right. It's one of the originals. So science suggests that Hurricane Maria was a natural disaster made worse by climate change, especially warming seas adding to storm strength. How do you see the collapse of hospitals in Puerto Rico in light of your 2017 Lancet report?
Yeah, I mean, really, that disaster just highlights why we need to be looking at this issue and why health systems, they need to be prepared. They're currently, a lot of health systems are very ill-prepared for disasters such as Hurricane Maria. And ultimately, they need help. They need climate forecasting so they can anticipate and plan for these climate-related disasters. They need climate-resilient infrastructure so when their power systems go down, they have backup generators to ensure they can continue, you know, delivering healthcare, basic healthcare. And ultimately, they need the resource and capacity to undertake all of this work. But I think a really important point, I mean, this all sounds like it costs a lot of money and it's going to be a huge burden on the health system. Actually, it's not. These all are good, common-sense things to do regardless of climate change. All that climate change is doing is just is making these issues more urgent. It's highlighting why health systems need to be prepared for these kind of events.
And what about emissions from the healthcare sector itself? Are they significant and what could be done to reduce them?
Yeah, they are significant. And I think there's kind of two primary reasons why we want to look at the emissions from the healthcare sector. The first is related to your earlier question of why doctors should be advocates on this. And ultimately, if doctors are talking about climate change impacting human health, the health sector as a whole needs to demonstrate that they're behind it and they're doing their part to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. The second issue is, yes, the health sector, they are a significant contributor themselves. If you look at the US health sector emissions, they alone are greater than the entire greenhouse gas emissions from the UK and represent sort of nearly 10% of US emissions. So these are big numbers we're talking about here.
Many of us dread the spread of tropical diseases like dengue fever to the United States or Europe. But this Lancet report adds a hidden burden of non-communicable diseases increasing under climate stress. Please take a little time to tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. It's a really good point, and it's one that we are hoping to do a lot more work in, actually, in 2018 and the years going forward to highlight just how much climate change can impact non-communicable diseases. A great example is looking at air pollution. Air pollution is related to climate change in kind of two key ways. So the first of which is that air pollution results from the burning of fossil fuels. So when coal is burnt, it releases greenhouse gas emissions. It also reduces particulate matter and other really nasty chemicals, which really exacerbate local air pollution. And we see that all over the world. And the second issue is that as our climate warms and we are exposed to more heat waves, that also worsens local air pollution. So you see a rise in ozone levels, which has really severe effects on human health. Kind of in terms of non-communicable diseases, the main things we see are things like lung cancer, really, you know, severe illnesses, which ultimately can result in people dying.
Yes, last week we talked with Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii, and he'd done some research into heat effects on the body. And he said that a lot of organs can be affected, including, I think he said, the liver. And then the person can die years later from the heat wave that happened.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So one of the things you do see with heat waves is people become, their bodies become stressed. Bodies function best at their core temperatures, which is 37.5 degrees. And as soon as heat rises above that and it's stayed above that, bodies, they can't cope. They can't maintain their core body temperature and they can't cool down ultimately. And one of the effects you see, for example, is kidney disease. People become dehydrated and their kidneys, they cannot function as they should.
Well, these days we hear less about mass famine, but doctors do warn about undernutrition. Nicola, what is that and how does climate change play into undernutrition?
Yes, undernutrition in the most basic sense is when people simply cannot get enough nutritious food to live a healthy lifestyle. In terms of climate change, ultimately, climate change can affect the food security of people. And we see this most commonly in low and middle income countries where people are more reliant on subsistence farming, so, you know, growing their own food, and they don't have the option of importing food from other countries. It's all very locally produced. And what we see in the paper is that between 1990 and 2016, the number of undernourished people has increased by 24 million. And this is in countries that are particularly vulnerable to climate change, so where we're seeing increased drought, increased heat waves, and in places where people are already particularly vulnerable to undernutrition itself. And also, these are in places, like I say, where they are dependent on local regional food production.
And I was surprised to read in the countdown that doctors are concerned about the statistics of red meat production and consumption. Why is that?
Yeah, so there's kind of two reasons for that, really. The first is related solely to the production side. So the livestock sector is a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions globally. It's about 14%. And of that 14%, cattle production alone is responsible for 65%. So these are, in itself, in the production, it's a huge contributor to climate change, but also in terms of consumption of red meat. Although it can be an important source of protein for some populations, overeating red meat actually poses quite a few significant health risks to people.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from University College London. My guest is Nicola Wheeler. She's the program officer for a huge running project by the leading medical journal, The Lancet. The medical community is tracking climate threats. Nicola, I'd like to pick up on one unusual item in this report, the possibility of ice crash disasters flooding out the billions of people who currently live in coastal cities. What is the warning in the report?
The warning essentially is that we need to be doing more. If we don't significantly mitigate climate change and if we don't put in place adaptation systems that enable people to live in their current environments and protect people against sea level rise, potentially, yeah, we are talking about a billion people that could be forced to leave their homes. I mean, this is, I would like to stress, under circumstances where there is no adaptation in place and, you know, under kind of very bad climate projections. But it's possible, and we're seeing it today. Already people are being forced to leave their homes. In Fiji, they're having to relocate coastal villages to higher land. In Alaska, we see 3,500 people already having been forced to migrate because of changing ice conditions. They simply cannot live where they used to live.
You know, it's just occurred to me it might be helpful for The Lancet to do an inventory of hospitals that would have to move if we had 1 or even 3 meters of sea level rise. Recreating a hospital is not easy or cheap. Would that be worth investigating, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And sea level rise is in itself something that we don't actually have an indicator on at the moment. But like I said, we are looking to expand these indicators and to improve them. So, yeah, that could be certainly something that we look into in future.
Nicola Wheeler, why are doctors calling for a total phase-out of coal?
Coal is really important. If there's one thing you can do to quickly help mitigate climate change and to vastly improve population's health around the world, it's phasing out coal. In terms of climate change, coal is responsible for 44% of carbon dioxide emissions globally. And it's also, as we discussed before, it's a major contributor to local air pollution. It emits a lot of particulate matter, which can have really severe pulmonary and cardiovascular health effects upon people.
And yet, it's still being burned in Europe, for example.
It is still being burned. We are seeing positive signs of progress. We last week had the announcement of the Coal Alliance, who are committing to phasing out coal. And we have seen that coal production and investment has peaked. So there are positive signs that we are beginning to move away from this outdated, dirty source of energy. But you're right, we're not there yet, and we need to do more.
I'm sorry, I missed the first thing that you said. An announcement of what?
So the Coal Alliance is a group of countries, including the UK and Canada, who have come together and committed to phasing out coal by 2030.
That would be good. I didn't even know Canada was a part of that, so I'm glad to hear that. I'm from Canada. Has there really been an increase in extreme weather events, or is it just better TV coverage?
There has been an increase, yeah. We find that there's been about a 46% increase in extreme weather events since 2007. Part of that could be down to better reporting, but really since 2007 we've had pretty robust sort of reporting and monitoring systems in place. So that's a huge increase in just 10 years.
According to this report, though, despite the floods and the fires and the heat waves, there's no obvious increase in people dying. Could you explain why?
Yeah, sure. We were quite surprised to find that, to be honest. With such a huge increase in the number of extreme weather events, we really thought there'd be a more kind of discernible trend in the number of deaths. But to date, there isn't. However, there are huge and very significant limits to adaptation. So what we think is happening is that at the moment, our response systems are sufficient. We're just able to cope with these extreme weather events. However, that's not going to be able to continue. As these, you know, if these weather events continue to increase at the rate that they have in the past 10 years, we need to significantly upscale our response systems, and we need to make huge adaptation efforts in order to ensure that the number of deaths don't increase in future.
Yes, I think the report does use a medical analogy about this limit to adaptation. I mean, our body can adapt to a certain amount of influx of disease or a virus or something, but at a certain point, we can't cope with it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, our bodies are only able to take so many hits, if you like. And ultimately, it gets to a point where it can't recover. And these systems are exactly the same. If you are dealing with an emergency response system that is constantly or frequently having to deal with these extreme weather events, ultimately, it's going to fall apart. It's not going to be able to deal with those anymore.
And the report suggests that despite some signs of climate action, which are discussed there, we still face warming of 2.6 degrees to 4.8 degrees C by the end of the century. The first is kind of a disaster. The second is definitely a catastrophe. And yet there are several very optimistic passages in this report, including in the conclusion, that seem to clash with those odds. How is that possible?
Yeah, you're right. It is. It's very concerning. And the thing that we highlight is that it's in the last 5 years only that we've seen this kind of increased response to climate change. So, for example, we've seen commitments to new coal power plants have halved just in 2016 to 2017. We've seen that since 2015, in every single year since 2015, there's been more renewable energy added to the global mix than all other sources combined. However, when we look at the big picture, in the last 25 years, our progress has been embarrassingly slow. We're really not doing enough to address this. And that's why we say, although there's kind of glimmers of hope, if you like, that in the last 5 years, we're beginning to do more. And perhaps this is the start of a transition to a low carbon world. We're not there yet. And we need an awful lot more in order to meet the Paris Agreement goals of, you know, keeping global temperatures below 2 degrees, let alone 1.5 degrees.
Well, as you said, the 2017 Lancet Countdown report also suggests that low and middle income countries will be hit hardest. But isn't that partly because population is expanding in regions that are already climate stressed?
It is partly to do with that. So the heat waves indicators that I mentioned earlier, a large portion of where those people are exposed is in India, where we see a huge rise in population. So it is partly due to that, but it's also partly due to, it just so happens that in countries that are least able to adapt, least able to cope with these extreme weather events, that's where these events are occurring.
You know, I think a lot of us think that with our good healthcare systems and with air conditioners, we're invulnerable to climate challenges. And do you think that people in developed countries are going to get a free pass?
No, absolutely not. we've already seen, so in Europe in 2003, over 70,000 people died during that summer when there was one of the most severe heat waves that's ever hit the continent. And quite simply, the health systems, they weren't prepared for it. They'd never dealt with anything like it before. And although they are, you know, they're starting to implement systems that are in place, ultimately they're going to have to deal with a lot more than just the occasional heat wave. And our results, we look at our countries implementing projects to improve their climate resilience. And actually, we're finding that the majority are not. Health systems simply aren't ready to cope with climate change. And actually, that's not just the case in low and middle income countries. That really is the case in high income countries, too.
Could you help us understand how this report fits in context with ongoing work by The Lancet and a view of how all this will be followed up in the future? What is the plan and the process?
Sure. So in terms of the Lancet countdown, we will be re-evaluating these indicators every single year between now and 2030. And what that will enable us to do is to every year build in this evidence of not looking 10, 20, 50 years in the future of how climate change is affecting the health of populations, but actually today, how it is already affecting human health. In terms of the broader picture of what the Lancet is doing, the Lancet is increasingly looking at not just climate change, but also this concept of planetary health, so how the health of humans is influenced by every environmental determinant.
But that is a huge project to keep track of all these indicators. How do you do it?
Yeah, so we have over 24 partners globally from every continent around the world. You know, we're working with the best people in the world, with experts from geographers, from climate modelers, economists, doctors, kind of every discipline you could think of, really. When we say it's multidisciplinary, we really do mean it.
This is almost like the Intergovernmental Panel reports, except that it's coming from the medical community.
I mean, that's very kind of you to say, yeah. I mean, it'd be wonderful if we could be something like that.
So how can people read this report for themselves or refer their doctors to it?
Sure. So you'll be able to find it on the Lancet website, or alternatively, you can go to www.lancetcountdown.org, and on that website, there'll be a link to the report.
And anybody can read it?
Anybody can read it. It's free to read.
Great. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about, Nicola?
I suppose one other final thing to maybe say is that we have also, alongside this main global report, we've produced a series of national policy briefs. So what these policy briefs do is that they look at, in particular countries, for example, the US, they draw out indicators that are particularly relevant to that country, and they tell that national story, and they provide policy recommendations for those countries. And they're also available on that website. So that's another great resource if you want to know more about these issues.
We've been talking about climate and health, the big picture, from the medical community called The Lancet. Our guest is Project Officer Nicola Wheeler. Nicola, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Here is a simple action you can take to help the planet a little bit. Please send a link to this radio program to your doctor, or a link to one of these interviews. There are the links to help you do just that in my weekly show blog. That's published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Tell your doctor, climate change isn't healthy for anyone. It kills. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and please join us again next week. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Few meetings today with a couple of members of Congress. One of the things that we said was, hey, we're here not to tell you to stop bad legislation, but we're here with some good legislation.
They are trying to put me in jail for resisting the occupation peacefully. They want to shut my voice. They don't want me to do anything to help my community.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Coming up in one moment, an interview with Issa Amro, human rights defender and co-founder of the activism group Youth Against Settlements. He talks about being on trial in an Israeli military court and facing 18 charges against him. His first court date was on October 29th, and the second one is scheduled for late December. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and this is the Electronic Intifada podcast. Today, we're joined by human rights defender Issa Amro. Issa is the founder and director of Youth Against Settlements, an activism group based in Hebron in the occupied West Bank. For years, he's been on the front line in the nonviolent defense of his neighborhood against armed and violent Israeli settlers and soldiers who are continuing the colonization of the Old City. Youth Against Settlements has been organizing regular protests, including the annual Open Shahada Street campaigns, against the ongoing closure of entire sections of the city to Palestinians since 1994, when 29 Palestinians were massacred during prayers by U.S.-born settler Baruch Goldstein. Now, along with activist Farid al-Atrash, Issa is currently on trial at an Israeli military court at Ofer Prison near Ramallah, under indictment for his protest activities dating back to 2010. The Israeli military has leveled 18 separate charges against him, while al-Atrash is being charged for his participation in the 2016 Open Shahada Street protest. Amro's lawyer, Gabby Lasky, told the Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz in 2016 that the sudden resuscitation of past events for which Amro was arrested and released at the time absolutely seems to be a matter of political persecution. Issa Amro has not only faced persecution and jail time by Israel, but by Palestinian Authority forces working with the Israeli military as a proxy force. Under the auspices of the Electronic Crimes Law, a measure passed by Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas over the summer, PA forces detained and charged Issa over Facebook posts critical of the PA's earlier arrest of the head of a radio station in Hebron. He was released on bail about a week later, and he told reporters he was beaten during interrogation. He was kept in a tiny, filthy cell, and no family, media, or international diplomats were allowed to attend his hearing in a PA court. Amnesty International has called all of the charges against Issa and Farid al-Atrash baseless. And in June, 39 members of the U.S. Congress, including Senator Bernie Sanders, sent letters to the U.S. State Department in support of Issa. Issa now joins us from Hebron. Issa Amro, thank you so much for being with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak.
So, Issa, you've been through a lot the last few months, on top of regular harassment, threats, and violence directed at you by Israeli settlers who are taking over your neighborhood. This is not the first time that you faced arrest and imprisonment by the Israeli army. Can you talk about what happened during the first military tribunal and what you think Israel is attempting to do through this process?
Yani, to be clear, that I'm not the only Palestinian who is targeted by the Israeli military system. It's about the system. It's about the military occupation and the violence and the oppression from the Israeli occupation on the Palestinian people. Many other human rights defenders are targeted. They were put in jail. They are attacked. They are intimidated. I am one of them. My friend Farid is one of them. They are trying to put me in jail for resisting the occupation peacefully. They want to shut my voice. They don't want me to do anything to help my community or to increase the awareness in the international community about the apartheid, about the discrimination, about the segregation in Hebron and in all over Palestine. It's kind of making me busy with my own trial instead of helping the Palestinian children and the Palestinian women and the Palestinian people who are suffering from daily abuses from the occupation and from the Israeli settlers. Me, personally, I am against the military system. I am against the military court. And the only solution to make Israel accountable according to the international law for its discrimination, for its desegregation, and for its settlements.
Can you talk about these 18 separate charges and really what it looked like that first day of the military tribunal, what the state called, who the state called as witnesses, and what kinds of accusations are being put against you?
I am accused of inciting to nonviolence. They accused me of incitement many times. They accused me of organizing illegal actions, participating in legal action. They mean that my participation in the peaceful protest and my involvement in organizing campaigns as Open Shuhada Street campaign, which is asking to open the closed shops, closed markets, closed streets. The persecutors said it loud in the courtyard that 1, 2, 3, 4, occupation no more is provocation and it's not allowed in the Israeli military system. According to the 101 law, which prohibits any kind of political general assembly of Palestinian people. We are not allowed to gather, 10 people are not allowed to gather for any political reason according to the military law 101. They can put me in jail for 10 years for raising the Palestinian flag. That is the military system. That is the military law. And that's what is happening, They don't want me to practice my General Assembly or to say no to the occupation or to say no to the apartheid policies, which I am suffering and my people are suffering from.
That's the voice of Issa Amro. He is the founder and director of Youth Against Settlement, speaking to us from Hebron in the occupied West Bank. Issa, last year, several members of the U.S. Congress toured Hebron with you. And during a visit to Washington, D.C. just a couple of weeks ago, you met with several members of Congress, including Senator Sanders and Congressman Keith Ellison. Major international human rights groups, along with 39 members of the U.S. Congress, have condemned Israel's treatment of you. Do you believe there's enough pressure on the Israeli government and its military to make a difference in your case and other cases against Palestinians facing similar accusations and indictments?
I can say that my case is rare. To have that much support is rare. The majority of the Palestinians, they don't have that support. I hope that this support will be for all the Palestinians and it will be against the occupation. It's a good beginning to make American politicians and international human rights organizations to speak loud against the occupation and to have the courage, really, to talk about the human rights violations, because Israel is trying to shut off everybody, even in the U.S. And as Gideon Levy said, that the occupation is destroying the democracy, not only in Israel, even in the USA and all over the world, because the occupation is trying to make the international community be silent and trying, you know, to make everybody accept that Palestinians will be second or third class citizens in their own country. It's a good beginning. We should build on that case, and we should ask them for more and support them to speak more and more against the occupation and against the human rights violations and in favor of the Palestinian full rights.
Issa, as I mentioned, you were also arrested, detained, and beaten by Palestinian Authority forces in September. How were you treated during that recent detention, and what are the similarities and differences between your treatment by the PA and your treatment by Israel?
I can't compare, you know, the PA with Israel. Israel is the oppressor. Israel is the main problem for the Palestinian people. The misbehavior of the Palestinian people, the Palestinian police toward me was really severe. I was really, you know, mistreated. I hope that they change their own misbehavior with their own people and support their people, you know, freedom of expression, and they should, you know, the Palestinian Authority should drop the cybercrime law, and they should respect human rights more and more, and they should not listen to the Israeli pressure to use this kind of detention against Palestinian activists and against all the Palestinians.
Let's take a step back for a few minutes here. Can you describe the everyday violence of the situation for you and your community in Hebron, in the old city where you live? Can you paint us a picture of what it is you and others are resisting every day?
You know, we in Hebron are resisting a kind of displacement, ethnic cleansing almost every day, segregation. You know, we have certain streets in Hebron where they ask you about your religion, and according to your answer, you walk on the main road or you walk on the side of the road. That is in 2017. This is what we are fighting. We are fighting Israeli settlers. They just came, to the city. You know, they claimed the city. They changed the names of our own streets, the names of our own neighborhoods from Palestinian Arabic names to an Israeli Hebrew names. You know, they are changing my own streets in my lifetime. They are moving my city to be a ghetto. You know, we can't move. You need to have a number to pass the checkpoint. Your friends who are not living in the city center, you know, in the areas which is inside the checkpoints, if you don't have a number and your name is not registered, you can't come in. So if your brother, your friends, if you want to hold a party, if you want to have a doctor, electrician, they can't come in without a special coordination. Even the Palestinian ambulance needs a special coordination, which means that you skip all the emergency cases, so Palestinians don't have access to emergency ambulance because of the occupation. Settler violence. Settlers, they attack us day and night with throwing stones, throwing Molotov cocktails, saying a lot of bad words against us without any kind of accountability and with full impunity. They broke into a Palestinian house 2 months ago, and it's against even the Israeli law. And the Israeli government is supporting that. It's the only country on earth where the government is contradicting its own legal system. They are supporting the settlers to steal Palestinian homes, to steal Palestinian land. On the other hand, the Israeli legal system in some cases are against that, but the Israeli government does nothing. This is the situation in Hebron, that we have around 1,800 shops closed because of the closure policy. 1,000 Palestinian apartments became empty. It's a ghost town. I invite all the listeners to come and watch by their eyes and have a first-hand testimony from the Palestinians who are suffering from oppression, intimidation, discrimination, apartheid every day. It's about, you know, that we say it loud. Nakba, Naksa, they didn't finish. They are trying to take more. They are trying to push Palestinians to leave their homes, to leave their land. That is the result of Balfour on the 100th anniversary of Balfour Declaration, that the international community is supporting Israel and they are denying the Palestinian rights and they are denying the Palestinian identity and denying the Palestinian suffer from the occupation and discrimination and apartheid.
And because of your work highlighting this this everyday violence of the occupation, you're looking at a heavy prison sentence. Do you think you'll be sent to an Israeli prison, and how are you preparing for that?
I am very sad about that. I am very disappointed even because, you know, using nonviolence resistance must be appreciated by everybody on the world. That is the best tool to end the occupation. It's not only about the sentence. You know, I'm already convicted. The conviction rate in the military court is more than 99.5%. It's not a just court. It's not a fair trial. It's a military court. The court is to strengthen the occupation, is to oppress me and to oppress other Palestinians. So I don't believe even in the military court. The military court is there to criminalize me, to put me in jail without a real reason. So it's not about me. It's about the military system and it's about the occupation. I don't want to go to jail. I'm not ready for that. I want to go on with my human rights work and my activities and actions for my own people. And I hope that more Palestinians will join because of what I'm doing and because of me trying to recruit them to the nonviolence resistance. I think the Palestinians, they have a very long history of nonviolence resistance. Now we are using the social media and using the new technology to highlight that, to increase the awareness about that, to mobilize the Palestinians. But the occupation, they don't want any kind of resistance, and they don't want the Palestinians even to say no to the occupation. Me personally, I really even suffer more on the ground these days. I'm always detained. I'm always attacked, blacklisted. You know, I don't have a normal life because of my human rights activities and my nonviolence approach.
Issa, finally, what's the next step for people who want to support you and the campaigns of Youth Against Settlements? What's the best way to get involved?
The people who want to support me, they should, you know, join the Palestinian solidarity groups all over the world. They exist. Just, you know, Google solidarity group in your own city or in your own country. You will find a lot of Palestinian solidarity groups, and they have a lot of very, very good campaigns against the occupation. That is very important. You know, try to use all kind of nonviolence campaigns to use it against the occupation. Media is very important. Target the media. The mainstream media till now is very biased, and they don't show the reality on the ground. Write to your politicians, to your senators, to your Congress members, to your parliament members, to make them take action and to speak loud against the occupation and encourage them to do so. Because I know many, they know that there is something bad happening these days, but they are afraid to speak because of the campaigns against them, or, you know, Israel tries to sabotage their own campaign to inform more people and send celebrities to Palestine, send more politicians and journalists to Palestine to see by their eyes what is happening on the ground. That is very, very important. And I think that we should not lose hope. I am very optimistic in spite of everything happening to me and everything happening in Palestine these days, that one day we will get our freedom, our justice, and our equality as everybody in the world.
Issa Amro, speaking to us from Hebron in the West Bank. Issa, thank you so much. And we will, of course, keep updating and following your case. Thank you. And please take care. That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Alex Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who discusses the surprise results of the November 26th Honduran presidential election. Barbara McLean with the group Planning Beyond Capitalism, who proposes the establishment of a women's solidarity network to provide support for victims of sexual harassment. And Wampanoag elder Bert Waters' reading of U.S. political prisoner Leonard Peltier's letter at the annual Day of Mourning Thanksgiving gathering at Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Conservative billionaire Sebastián Piñera won the opening round of Chile's presidential election to replace current President Michelle Bachelet, who was barred from running for another term. In mid-December, Piñera will face off against socialist Alejandro Guillier, who has the support of Bachelet's center-left coalition. When Bachelet steps down, there will be no women presidents in Latin America. Just a few years ago, female leaders governed Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Costa Rica. Advocates for women leadership in the region hope this is a pause and not a concession to Latin machismo. Bachelet, who served two terms, liberalized strict anti-abortion laws and secured pension bonuses for women who left the workforce to care for their families. Yet, she was unable to reduce violence against women. Still, women have made progress across Latin America since the 1990s. Now, every nation except Guatemala has quotas for female members of local and national legislatures. In the last 20 years, the number of female lawmakers across the region has doubled. In January 1997, Princess Diana walked through an active minefield in war-torn Angola to raise awareness about the threat posed by landmines. 2017 marks the 20th anniversary of the International Landmine Treaty signed by 163 nations. In 2015, over 6,500 people were killed by landmines and cluster munitions. It was double the number of deaths from the previous year, driven mostly by the ongoing war in Syria. But these are far fewer casualties than during the 1990s, when nearly 25,000 people were killed by landmines annually. According to the Christian Science Monitor, over the last 5 years, 370 square miles of minefields were cleared, destroying over 1.3 million anti-personnel landmines. The vast majority of mines cleared were in Afghanistan, Cambodia, and Croatia, heavily agricultural nations. For many poor nations like Angola, landmines held back economic recovery and limited the restoration of agriculture. On the eve of Thanksgiving, federal Judge Lee Eagle overruled Texas Senate Bill 8, which prevented doctors from performing certain second trimester abortions such as dilation and extraction. Judge Eagle ruled the law placed a burden on women to exercise their reproductive rights, especially since the law required a risky procedure to first stop a fetus's heart. The ruling was a major victory for abortion rights activists and Planned Parenthood. In his opinion, Judge Eagle wrote, "The court concludes requiring a woman to undergo a risky, invasive, and experimental procedure in exchange for exercising her right to choose substantially burdens that right." Immediately after the ruling, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed an appeal with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. On several occasions, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled state governments cannot place an undue burden on a woman's access to an abortion before the fetus is viable. Bans similar to the Texas law have been struck down in states, including Alabama, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Pollsters and pundits had predicted that the Honduras November 26 presidential election would maintain the status quo, with incumbent conservative president Juan Orlando Hernandez easily winning re-election. But it appears that voters had a different outcome in mind. Opposition candidate Salvador Nasralla, one of the nation's best-known television personalities, was holding a 5-point lead over Hernandez before the nation's Supreme Electoral Tribunal stopped announcing vote totals, with 57% of the ballots counted. Both candidates have claimed victory. The tribunal's decision to freeze the public vote count the day after the election generated suspicion that attempts were being made to manipulate the outcome. Nasralla ran as the candidate of the Alliance Against Dictatorship, a coalition formed with the leftist party of former President Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted in a U.S.-supported military coup in 2009. Hernandez, a close ally of Washington, had been widely criticized for engineering the Supreme Court's override of the Honduran Constitution's ban on consecutive presidential terms, widespread corruption, human rights violations, and the assassination of environmental activists, including Goldman Prize winner Berta Cáceres. Your reporter spoke with Alex Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses what may be a surprise outcome of the Honduran election and the danger of another military coup.
Nasralla, he is sort of a figure who's on the center right. It's not very clear. He's not very clearly defined politically because he hasn't really had much of a political career. He first ran for president in 2013. Before that, he'd never held an elected office. And in 2013, he ran on basically an anti-corruption platform. And in fact, the name of his party is the Anti-Corruption Party. He did get, you know, a good amount of votes, especially for a first-time candidate in those elections. And then afterwards, he sort of formed an informal alliance with the Libre Party, which is a left-leaning party that is really sort of an offshoot of the movement of resistance to Honduras's 2009 coup. And some of your listeners may remember that there was the military coup d'etat against elected president Manuel Zelaya at the time. He was forced out of power at gunpoint, shipped off to Costa Rica. And in the meantime, you had a great deal of repression in Honduras. But also you had a huge movement, massive protests, and a very organized movement that opposed the coup. And that wanted to see as well a constituent assembly to sort of, you know, reform what a lot of people saw as a very rotten political system in Honduras. And out of this movement sprung a new political party, which included a lot of members of a traditional party from the left wing of the Liberal Party. And that party was formed in 2011. The head of that party is the deposed president from 2009, President Manuel Zelaya. And so that party is called Libre, or Freedom, and it joined in an alliance with Nasralla's party, the Anti-Corruption Party. You know, few people thought that they would be successful, in part because the private media was sort of universally against them and favorable to the incumbent president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, of the National Party, which is very pro-military, very conservative, and really the biggest beneficiary of the coup politically. And because of Juan Orlando Hernandez's really complete control over the institutions, in particular the courts, and within the court system, the electoral authority, and the TSE. It was believed that if Nasralla had any chance of winning, fraud would take place. And it does seem that fraud probably has taken place, but that the margin of victory of Nasralla was, you know, so great that, you know, fraud couldn't really make that difference. But now the big question is whether this coalition, which includes this left-wing party and this sort of center-right Party is going to hold together, because they do indeed have different political programs. And it'll be interesting to see if, in fact, Nasrallah does end up being the winner of these elections, and we still have to wait for the TSC to announce the final results. And there's still a possibility of fraud occurring. But if that occurs, what sort of cabinet is he going to have? And what cabinet positions are Libre going to have? What is he going to have? And also, what will be the results of the congressional elections? Because those have taken place as well. The TSC has announced really very few results for the congressional races. And if this coalition doesn't have a majority in Congress, it's going to be very difficult for them to govern.
What is the danger, in your estimation, of another military coup at the hands of the Honduran army? A second part of that question would be, what is the U.S. role here in this election, if any, under the Trump administration, given the history of U.S. backing under the Obama administration for the 2009 coup?
Well, those are two excellent questions, and I think they're very, very linked. And that is because the U.S. provides a lot of training and a lot of equipment and financial support to the Honduran security forces. When you ask whether or not there's a possibility of a military coup, I would say that there is, certainly, especially as the military is very opposed to the Libre Party. With Nasrallah's victory, can potentially be back in power in the government. And the military won't want to see that. And they may act again as they acted in 2009 to prevent that from happening. But there, of course, the U.S. has a tremendous amount of leverage in terms of, you know, their relationship with the Honduran military. It's often said in Honduras that no election result becomes official without the U.S. embassy, you know, basically recognizing the results of the election.
That was Alex Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. For more news and analysis of the Honduran presidential election and the human rights conditions in the country, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The explosion of public accusations denouncing perpetrators of sexual harassment over recent weeks has provoked a national dialogue and debate on how society should address the ancient scourge of male sexual aggression and violence. The powerful men named have come from the worlds of movie making, media, business, sports, and politics. While movie producer Harvey Weinstein was the subject of early attention for his long history of predatory behavior, soon other well-known men were named, including actors Kevin Spacey, talk show host Charlie Rose, comedian Louis C.K., Democratic Senator Al Franken, and Michigan Representative John Conyers. However, the well-documented charges of pedophilia leveled against Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, who professes to be a fundamentalist Christian, has exposed the selective way in which many political activists accept or reject credible charges of sexual misconduct made against their allies. In this unique moment of collective awakening on sexual harassment, there have been very few concrete proposals on how society could address this age-old epidemic of male sexual coercion and bullying. One exception was a proposal made in an article titled "Beyond Harvey Weinstein, What Can Be Done?" written by socialist feminist Barbara McLean, a founder of the group Planning Beyond Capitalism. Your reporter spoke with McLean, who discusses her proposal to form a women's solidarity network that could offer legal and educational assistance to groups of women combating sexual harassment and assault.
I don't want to take credit for this because I read a wonderful article by Jonathan Cook in Dissident Voice. And what, I don't know if you all are familiar with him. If you're not, you should check him out. He's a wonderful journalist. And what he proposed is that, and he was specifically speaking about Hollywood, that they form unions in Hollywood for actresses and actors at any stage of their career, so that particularly these young actresses, the focus right now is on women, so I'm not saying men have not been abused. They have, and it needs to be addressed. But I think, you know, to kind of get a framework around women, if there was some kind of union organization that could work with women, so when they had complaints, they had a place to go, they could register the complaints, the union could collect those complaints, put them together into a group, and then take some kind of class action, maybe file a class action suit against this individual. I think this is brilliant. I think it's wonderful. But I think it needs to go further. I think, as we're finding out, this is happening not just in Hollywood. It's happening in the Supreme Court, in the White House, in tech. It's happening everywhere, and it's happening in much smaller businesses. So there needs to be something beyond simply a union for women in, say, Hollywood or the arts. So we need to start looking in a larger context. How can we protect all women? And if instead of having a woman's union, we frame it as a women's solidarity network, then this could be something that all women could get behind. And there could be chapters all over the country. My hope would be that groups like, say, Southern Poverty Law Center, other legal aid groups, could work with these women to educate them about their rights, and when necessary, to actually file lawsuits on their behalf. So that's kind of like the beginning of where this came from.
In your article, you talk about the explosion of activism that we saw back in 2011 around the Occupy Wall Street movement. And that was almost a spontaneous movement that erupted across the country, in fact, in places all over the world. Do you have any hope that your idea of a woman's solidarity network could take off in a similar way, or is something like this project a more difficult task that'll take a lot more effort to push, to launch in a way that will be long-lasting?
I'm not sure. One of the things that I've thought about is starting small and simply starting a Facebook group, a Twitter account, to see how many women and men would want to get on board with this. I've watched Black Lives Matter. You know, that was initiated in Oakland, California, where I live, by a very small group of women sitting around after the last police attack on a young black man. And they said, enough, this is enough. And they formed this. There were maybe less than half a dozen of them. And look what's happened to them now. You say Black Lives Matter. Everybody knows what you're talking about. But the fact is, that took off like wildfire. How wonderful if this could take off like wildfire. These types of stratifications, these types of inequalities with women go back before our lifetimes. For generations, it was something that all of us simply accepted and frequently just laughed off and said, well, that's how men are and that's how it is. And, you know, we just kind of have to put up with it. So my hope is that all of those women who have put hashtag MeToo, sometimes told their stories, sometimes not, that they see that there could be some kind of organization that could help to fight this.
That was Barbara McLean, a socialist feminist and a founder of the group Planning Beyond Capitalism. Find a link to McLean's article Beyond Harvey Weinstein, What Can Be Done, and related material by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Thanksgiving Day this year marked the 48th annual Day of Mourning on Coles Hill, overlooking Plymouth Rock in Plymouth, Massachusetts, where the Pilgrim myth got its start. The gathering is organized by the United American Indians of New England and featured speakers from Labrador to Puerto Rico to Guatemala. Those addressing the gathering paid tribute to American Indian Movement co-founder Dennis Banks, who died on October 29th at age 80. Part of the yearly commemoration includes the reading of a letter from Indigenous political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who's been incarcerated for the past 41 years. He was convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota in 1975, although no evidence links him to the crime, and he's always maintained his innocence. At last year's event, Peltier's letter expressed the hope that President Barack Obama would commute his sentence, especially after the prosecutor in Peltier's case recommended he be freed. However, Obama declined to do so, and there's virtually no chance of a commutation under President Donald Trump. But his short letter, read this year by Wampanoag elder Bert Waters, reflects no bitterness and shows that Peltier's sense of humor and love for the people remain intact. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the Day of Mourning gathering, where she recorded and produced this segment featuring the reading of Peltier's letter.
Statement of Leonard Peltier to National Day of Mourning, Plymouth, Mass., November 2017. Greetings, my friends, relatives, and supporters. Once again, I can't tell you how much I am so honored that you would want to hear my words, or should I say, read my words. You can't imagine the thoughts that go through my head at times, whenever anything or everything is still and quiet in the night, when I lie there staring into the dark with daydreams of how things could possibly be better. I know I've said this once before in some past statement years back. However, it comes to my thoughts how the term Day of Mourning makes me think of a reverse, as in the morning of the new day, and how one term refers to those caught up in a deep sorrow, and how the other term is a promise of a new beginning and the rising of the sun. In our traditions and culture, most tribal nations historically did a mourning period of 1 year for the deceased. However, for us during this point in time, we are continually losing our people, and especially our young people and our women who continually disappear with no trace. Ours lands are constantly violated. The air, the water, the soil, all of nature is screaming against the injustice that is continually perpetrated by those who worship money. So, in essence, I want to say in the loudest voice and in the most sincere voice I can possibly speak, we don't have a day of mourning. We have generations of mourning, year after year. I don't know what I can do further from where I'm at, but in whatever way possible, I want to add my scream to the scream of the earth and the scream of our people for justice. These ecological disasters caused by the wealthy must stop. Those people who are destroying the earth must realize that they ultimately will destroy themselves also. I know many of you have taken part in the prayers and vigils and stood strong in the face of wrongful beatings and shootings and various other forms of violence, and I commend you for your bravery. Having said that, I want to encourage you to move forward to a new day. With each new day, we need to rise to the occasion to defend what is right and to do what we can to right what is wrong. Our enemy is not any person of particular color. Our enemy is those who are ignorant of reality that we are all intricate part of the whole circle, the circle of life. We must arm ourselves with the knowledge it takes to bring attention to the wrongness of their thinking, the wrongness of their exploitation of our Mother Earth, and wrongness of their mistreatment of the indigenous peoples throughout our lands. I would encourage you to mourn, if that is your way, to whatever length of time that is required by your teachings. However, I sincerely encourage each and every one of you to take it upon yourself to become a warrior of one. Educate yourself. Find the knowledge it takes to survive and thrive in a good way, and to confront the ignorance of those who are destroying the natural. Confront them in such a way that they will come to know that to destroy the earth, to destroy our people, to continually ignore the philosophy and teachings that allowed this land to exist since the beginning of time in a beautiful natural existence, they will ultimately destroy themselves and all life. Perhaps I've said too much. I don't know what your agenda is today. Obviously, I have more time than you. I want to say in closing, though, I love you, and I love you wherever you are. I love you, and I love what you want. I love that you want to make a difference, and I will pray for you always. I further want to say, you are making a difference. You have made a difference. Power to the people. Power to the earth.
That was Wampanoag Elder Bert Waters reading Leonard Peltier's annual letter at the Day of Mourning Thanksgiving gathering at Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts. Learn more about the campaign to free Leonard Peltier and Indigenous activist groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KSER in Everett, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
at Second Amendment. Historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is known best for her award-winning work, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, published in 2014. But lovers and readers of history know that she is a prodigious writer who has penned a considerable amount of history, much of it about what Americans have come to call Indian country. But her newest work is also groundbreaking, for she dares to attack the sacred text of the Holy Constitution and breaks down the forces and sources that has brought its Second Amendment, Weapons and Firearms Clause, into being. By so doing, she challenges her colleagues in the bright lights of history written before to make points how and why we consider the Second so special. She engages in the hidden history that made the Second so desirable and so powerful that it had to be hidden. From European landfall to today, she recounts that which is indisputable, that America is a creation of genocide, slavery, and mass death. From the first days of the emergence of Euro-America, Europeans sought to extinguish non-European life. Indians, Africans, others. The gun, far more than the Bible, made this so. Using archival and published sources, she excavated texts and tables to reveal the sources of something I've never heard of before that is a distinguished mark of America's deep martial roots, gun love. As a young woman, Dunbar Ortiz writes, she was a member of a political collective that, during the 60s, armed themselves for self-defense. Soon, it became the central concern of her collective. Ortiz writes, it seems that our group and others in the years that the Vietnam War was playing out live on our televisions were in the vanguard of a trend of owning multiple weapons. Army and Navy surplus clothing accompanied this trend, which was soon replaced by sweatshop-produced camouflage garb to meet consumer demand. Something else was also at work. In Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, published by City Lights forthcoming, Ortiz journeys into untrodden ground, identifying that something else and the deep social forces that gave Americans special hunger for Indian lands, what Hitler and company called Lebensraum, living space. That land hunger was accompanied by the intense hatred against Indian people, and further, the monstrous African slave trade, all of which was done to enrich the wallets of white America. Loaded is a work of brilliance, of intense historical engagement, and of revelation of the America and how it came to be. She smashes the idols of mass worship of the gun and our idolatry of it by showing what truly lies beneath. She desacralizes the Second Amendment, casts it from the vault of heaven, and leaves it lying in the muck and mire, the blood, the hatreds that truly formed America. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. flashing something? Is it something in the water? In the last few days, we've seen more shocks than an electric eel. Women are popping up like dandelions after a summer rain, recounting deeply submerged memories of attacks, indecencies, and assaults, many from decades ago. By now, I think many, many women awoke during the massive, unprecedented Women's March against Trump during the spring. It was, according to my research, the biggest demo and protest in American history. I think the demo gave many women a sense of their potential power, a sense of their feminine strength. That awakening led to a sense of how women could command social space, social power, especially in the area of social interaction. That which once led to social silence now leads to social outrage and perhaps, social change. In this supposed democracy, women are rarely ever a political majority. Why aren't they the majority of Congress, of mayors, of judges, or DAs? Why don't they control the councils, boards of education, businesses, churches? Perhaps this isn't a democracy after all. For it would be insane to beat, assault, disparage, or rape that segment of the population that constitute its very majority, right? Unless this population has been socially, psychologically intimidated, quietly accepting their subordinate status, unless they were conditioned from their earliest days as girls to play nice with their very abusers and assailants, unless they were trained to see themselves as less than their brothers, fathers, and men generally. Unless they were mistaught so that when they are raped, abused, diminished, it is their fault, for they were now somehow unclean. Until day breaks, and on a sunlit morn in January, millions of women take to the streets and see for once their immense power. Movements such as these do far more than change minds. They can change nations. From imprisoned nation, from rape nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 1st, 2017. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues facing our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. On this week's show, we depart from our regular format to pay tribute to the life and work of media critic and anti-war activist Edward Herman. Over the course of the next hour, we'll hear from individuals who have been influenced and enlightened by the work of Edward Samuel Herman, who died on November 11th, 2017, of bladder cancer. He was 92. Edward Herman was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in April of 1925, a self-described depression baby. He was the son of pharmacist father and a homemaker mother, both liberal Democrats. He included, among his early influences, the economic downturn of the 1930s, the events of the Second World War, and relatives with radical political leanings. After obtaining his bachelor's and a Master of Arts degrees at the University of Pennsylvania, he would attend the University of California, Berkeley, and earn a Doctor of Philosophy degree in 1953. In those post-war years, Berkeley was a breeding ground for radical thought. The economist Robert Brady and his book The Spirit and Structure of German Fascism proved to be influential on Edward Herman's thinking. Edward Herman would join the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Finance in 1958. His PhD thesis concerned the Bank of America system. Over the next 15 years, he would work on group studies on financial institutions, with he as the specialist on corporate control. By the early 70s, he would get involved with the anti-war movement, where he would connect with the noted linguist and dissident Noam Chomsky. The two of them collaborated on three books in the 1970s, including Counter-Revolutionary Violence, Bloodbaths in Fact and Propaganda in 1973, as well as The Political Economy of Human Rights, Volume 1, The Washington Connection and the Third World Fascism in 1979, and The Political Economy of Human Rights, Volume 2, After the Cataclysm, Post-War Indochina and the Reconstruction of Imperial Ideology, also in 1979. By the 1980s, Herman's interest and expertise in corporate structure and power within the larger societal framework would lead to the famous deconstruction of the mainstream media found in his most famous collaboration with Chomsky, The Manufacture of Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, published in 1988. The opening chapter of Manufacturing Consent is entitled A Propaganda Model. Herman and Chomsky assert that in a society such as that in the United States, there are inequalities in power, wealth, and influence. Elite elements of the society are able to exert their influence on media output through various mechanisms that filter the news to their advantage, marginalize dissent, and facilitate the expression of propaganda favoring the wealthy and their agents in the state. Herman and Chomsky identified five specific filters. Number one, the size and concentrated ownership and profit orientation of the dominant mass media outlets. Number two, advertising as the media firm's main source of revenue. Number three, the reliance on information provided by so-called experts in government and business who have the approval and funding of elite elements of society. Number four, so-called flack, or negative feedback, which acts to discipline the media in question when they step beyond established parameters of thought. And finally, number five, anti-communism as a national religion and control mechanism. In the follow-up chapters, Manufacturing Consent would provide a number of case studies which differentiate how tragedies and humanitarian crises are dealt with differently depending on the status of the target community as an enemy or ally. This discrepancy is referred to in Chapter 2 as the worthy and unworthy victims. Manufacturing Consent proved to be a seminal work for a generation of activists who recognized the importance of media in shaping the perceptions of the general public in a way that served imperial powers and major corporate interests. One of the activists influenced by Herman's work was none other than frequent guest, colleague, and friend Stephen Lendman. Stephen Lendman is a writer, radio host, and independent journalist. He, too, attended the Wharton School of Finance at the University of Pennsylvania, where he obtained his MBA in 1960. He worked as a marketing research analyst until joining his family's business in 1967, where he would work until retiring in 1999. Stephen relayed the critical role Edward Herman played in redirecting his own political thinking. So we're joined right now by Stephen Lendman. That's great to have you back on the show, Stephen.
Michael, it's great to be back on with you and delighted to be able to talk about Ed Herman. Sad that he passed. He was age 92, and you get into your 90s, you probably are getting close to your end time. But it's never pleasant to think about somebody who's important and has done so much good work to no longer be with us, Michael. I know we agree on that.
You mentioned in an article you published a couple of days after his death that Edward Herman inspired your embarking on a second career as a journalist and political writer. Was there a specific article or book in particular that hooked your interest?
Well, he inspired me in a number of ways, Michael. I think if I hadn't read all of his books, I came very close, and I've got them all on my bookshelf. But I connected to Ed in an unusual way. I never had a home computer until nearly age 71, I confess. And my daughter convinced me to get one, and she broke me in. She showed me the basics, and I was off and running. I had no idea that it would change my life, and indeed it did. Before that, I wrote letters to people, friends, and other people, including Ed, letters which I wrote in an unusual way. They were very long. I hand-wrote them, and then I edited them and rewrote them. I wrote Ed a letter. A couple of weeks later, he answered me, so we connected in that way. Once I got a computer, there was no need to hand-write letters anymore. Everything done online, which is the best way to do it, of course. But that's how I connected with Ed. I've spoken to him a number of times. He contributed to the book that I edited and contributed to on Ukraine, Flashpoint in Ukraine. That was in 2014. And I miss him very much.
He largely focused on the propaganda system within the United States. And it certainly was, his manufacturing consent was an eye-opener. Co-written with Noam Chomsky was a big eye-opener for me, and it sort of kind of paved the way to my own activism and journalism. So I'm just wondering if there are specific elements of his message that speaks to you on an ongoing basis.
Well, he was very strongly anti-war. His manufacturing consent with Noam Chomsky, that was the seminal work, the one that they're best noted for. And Ed wrote most of the book. I'm not certain what percentage each of them contributed, but it was really Ed's book and Chomsky contributed to it. And Ed was a media critic. Chomsky more a political activist in other ways, but Ed, one of his attributes besides being a political economist, he was a media critic, so it was natural for him to write a book like this. I've quoted him from that book a number of times over the years in articles that I've written, and I've got the book on my shelf. It's just marvelous. I hope I've got the chapter right. I think one of the chapters in the book was Worthy and Unworthy Victims. And I wrote an article years ago using that title, and he commented to me saying, Steve, that was chapter six, I'll have to check it. That was chapter six of my book, and I forgot about that. I went back to look at it and said, indeed it was. So I apologize to Ed. I don't think I mentioned manufacturing consent in my article, but I used that as a title. It was what he used as a title of one of his chapters. But again, it was a marvelous book. But he's done so much more. Co-authored with Chomsky, written by himself, co-authored with one of our other contributors. A lot of anti-war activism. I think he was as well known for that in the books that he's written as manufacturing. Not as well known. Manufacturing Consent is his best known work. But certainly, from my perspective, his anti-war activism every bit as important, maybe more important.
I wonder if you could comment on how Edward Herman's message applies today at a time when we're seeing independent media outlets under attack as being fake news or Russian, useful idiots or whatever, allegations of Russian meddling in the U.S. elections and distortions of the regime change operations in Syria and Ukraine. What is Edward Herman's message? How does it apply today?
Well, I think he pretty clearly showed the way the major media works in America and other Western societies. Again, their mission is the title of his book, Manufacturing Consent. It wasn't the first major media critique book. Michael Parenti wrote the first one. And I don't remember the title, but I read it years ago, and it's on my shelf, probably written maybe in the 1960s or so. I'd have to go back and check the publication date. But I believe that was the first major one. the Chomsky, the Herman Chomsky book, the second one, better known. It's a shame. Michael's book also was a marvelous, marvelous book. It doesn't get the credit that it deserves compared to Manufacturing Consent. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think that I guess one other point I was hoping to raise with you was the issue of, well, your own, maybe any personal anecdotes you have to share with regard to Mr. Herman, like any personal interactions or any common areas of interest, inquiry.
I didn't really answer your last question very well. I think
you want to start over? Should I ask you again?
We could just continue on. I think Ed would right to the end, I believe, and I don't think he was doing too well health-wise at the end. He was dealing with bladder cancer, and that was the cause of his death. I don't know how long he dealt with that, but cancer is a very, very tough illness to go through. Ed was very concerned about the state of the world and where we're heading. The media is simply an example of that, simply suppressing truth-telling on vital issues. And the things going on today which obsess Ed the way they obsess me and obsess any individual that's really concerned about having a world at peace and ending imperial wars and so on is we're really heading into a dark age. Well, we're already in an age of endless imperial wars. The possibility of a nuclear war is very, very great. We've got the people in Washington, whether it's Trump and the hawkish generals in the administration at the Pentagon, with intent on regime change in all independent countries, an issue I address over and over again. And the idea of targeting these countries, America's favorite strategies, are either color revolutions or wars, and we can see all the wars ongoing now. We either have to find a way to stop this stuff, or we're going to end up in a nuclear war. It could be on the Korean Peninsula. It could be against Russia. It could be against Iran. It could be against all three. And I've said many times in articles, that's the ultimate doomsday scenario. If that happens, I don't see any hope for humanity. We could all be doomed. A nuclear war is the end of things. One bomb isn't an issue, but a nuclear war would involve more than one bomb. And if there's a war against Russia, they can come back at the USA the same way as they could hit Russian territory. But we really have we have people in Washington who believe the way to achieve global dominance is by eliminating all these independent governments, and the main strategy, color revolutions for certain, had enough of those, but the main strategy seems to be war, and again, we see so many of them ongoing now. It's a very, very dangerous time. I can't remember any other time in my life that I have been more concerned about the state of things going on than now, and I think that I'm glad that I'm old, not young, Michael, because as a young person, I don't know what I'd have to look forward to.
I just one more comment I'd like to get from you before you close is that something I find a little bit interesting. You just told me before we started this interview that you actually crossed paths with Edward Herman in the distant past.
I sure did. He and I were at the Wharton School together in the 1950s. He was a financial researcher. He later became a professor of finance. I was in marketing. The only finance course I took was one in money and banking that told me everything about the Federal Reserve except what I needed to know, the way they teach it there. A lot of formulas and so on unrelated to the real workings of the Fed and money and banking, which I've written about quite a lot in my articles. But Ed and I were there at the same time. I never met him, I'm sad to say. I think we would have become friends had I done it because I know he was activist back then. And I remember once he said to me, I think I asked him, how did you get along back at the Wharton School, given what you do and so on? And he made a comment something like, they tolerated me.
I want to thank you for sharing these thoughts with us.
Thank you, Michael. Always a pleasure to be on with you.
That was writer and frequent global research contributor Stephen Lendman. Jeff Cohen has a long history with Herman. He's the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a media watchdog group. On November 14th, Cohen wrote an article for the FAIR website entitled Edward S. Herman, Master of Dissent. The Global Research News Hour contacted him to elaborate on his thoughts and recollections of Edward Herman.
one of the big reasons I founded FAIR was because of Herman and Chomsky. Their critiques were so clear, using case studies of how there's so much negative coverage in the U.S. about enemy states, but right next door, if there's an allied government that has far worse human rights record, that will get far less coverage in U.S. media. The case studies that those two did were sort of why we formed FAIR. The other key influencer was Ben Bagdikian, who had written so brilliantly about the impact of media conglomerates. But when it came to analyzing the content of news, it was Herman and Chomsky. And before I started FAIR, I was briefly an attorney. And I was in El Salvador on a lawyer's delegation. We were monitoring one of these elections where obviously the left could not participate because the left were victims of death squads. And we went down there, U.S. attorneys, trying to monitor this alleged election. And while we're down there, the week that we were there, Edward Herman's book with Frank Broadhead called Demonstration Elections came out, and they rushed us like a box of books. And the lawyers, the, you know, progressive and civil rights lawyers who are in El Salvador are eating up this book, because what the book showed is that in many different places, Dominican Republic, Vietnam, El Salvador, part of the U.S. propping up a right-wing puppet regime would be staging these elections. And here's how they would do it. And here's the kind of media coverage in the United States that would ensue when the U.S. set up a demonstration election in a country like El Salvador. So it was very, very helpful. And yes, Ed Herman's work was instrumental in my thinking when I came up with the idea that we need to have a progressive media watch group that did well-documented studies of U.S. media bias. Mm.
Did FAIR's work alter or change or maybe refine in its – become more refined in its analysis after manufacturing consent came out?
I'm not sure about that. I think we were already on the Herman Chomsky wavelength. Noam Chomsky was one of the first members of our advisory board. So manufacturing consent is a great achievement. But I, you know, we were reading all of their books. And I think the one thing that we tried to do at FAIR was to take the Herman Chomsky analysis and popularize it. I mean, Herman and Chomsky were writing these books. Certainly back when they were first published, did not get a lot of attention, did not get much attention in the mainstream media. So the reason for FAIR was to take this well-documented critique of U.S. media bias and try to get it into the mainstream media. And, you know, so I would appear on TV making some of the arguments that Herman and Chomsky had made in their 400-page books, and I would try to boil it down to a two-minute soundbite. And we were writing op-ed columns, and we were getting our small newsletter and magazine inside the New York Times newsroom and the Washington Post and public TV, PBS. You know, we were trying to take the Herman Chomsky analysis and bring it to the masses and force it in front of the eyes of mainstream journalists. Mm.
Now, speaking about mainstream journalism, I understand that you've worked in mainstream corporate media. You were a commentator for CNN, Fox, and MSNBC, and even served as a senior producer for broadcaster Phil Donahue's program before it got canceled in the lead-up to the Iraq War. Having been inside the sausage factory, in a sense, could you comment on any experiences or observances you had which maybe reinforced or countered what Herman and Chomsky had said about the propaganda model?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, I'm over there. The one time, the deepest I got into the mainstream media is when I worked every day at MSNBC in their big newsroom in 2002, 2003, which were the months leading up to the Iraq invasion. And I remember talking to my former colleagues at FAIR And, you know, my one-sentence conclusion is, it's worse than we thought. You know, when you're inside the sausage factory, it's worse than you could ever imagine. And, you know, the thing about Herman and Chomsky is they focused on the content. Their analysis wasn't how does the sausage get made, it's what's wrong with the sausage and why is it so wrong and why is it so unhealthy. So I'm on the inside, and I'm on the inside during a crisis for U.S. mainstream journalism, which is the White House is pushing the country and the world to a war, invasion of Iraq. They're doing it on the basis of claims that are almost ludicrous on their face. And so the mainstream media is in a real bind. And I worked on the show, as you mentioned, the Phil Donahue primetime show on MSNBC, and we were putting on like former UN weapons inspectors or trying to put them on the air who were saying, no, they don't have any weapons. And if they have any biological or chemical weapons, they're totally degraded and harmless by now. We brought on the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, and then management at MSNBC told us, oh, he's not supposed to be on this network. And remember, I'm talking about 2002, not 1952. But there was I learned there was some sort of blacklist at MSNBC. And when we would put like Scott Ritter on the air, who was a former UN weapons inspector who totally challenged the notion that the U.S. Had to invade Iraq over the weapons of mass destruction. After we'd put him on the air, the next day we would hear all these smears in the newsroom that Scott Ritter was getting funded by Saddam Hussein. And indeed, one person at MSNBC went on the air with no evidence. There never is any evidence. There never was any evidence that Scott Ritter was being paid by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, was somehow getting Saddam Hussein's funds. So, yes, when I was on the inside and saw how the sausage was made, I could add a little bit, because Chomsky and Herman, they didn't waste a lot of time. They left it to other scholars and researchers to interview mainstream reporters, why did you do this and not do that? They always get attacked, including in Ed's obituaries, mainstream obituaries, I should say, for not interviewing enough journalists. Well, yeah, it's worthy to do that. It's also worthy to just spend hours and weeks and months and years, as Herman and Chomsky did, looking at the content of the news. There's a lot of value in that. And I lucked out through a fluke in my career where I was already armed with the Herman Chomsky critique of the media and the Ben Bagdikian critique of media conglomerate ownership. And then I did get on the inside and I saw it was as bad or worse than anyone could have known.
How about that? Kind of reminds me a little bit about what you might see these days is certain inconvenient opinions being funded by Russian backers as opposed to Saddam.
Yeah,
but
yeah. It's the same thing. What I saw when I was inside mainstream media, which was decades after the anti-communist Joe McCarthy witch hunts, is there was still, and television, of course, was a medium that was born in the era of the witch hunts. I saw this allergy to having progressive points of view on. And they would have in mainstream media, and I've written about this a lot, and so did Chomsky beginning in the late 60s, the phony debates, the narrow debates where, you have a centrist corporate Democrat yelling at a Republican and they're spewing, they're ranting, they seem to hate each other. But the debate never goes beyond the center to right. It never goes beyond a corporate spectrum. It never goes beyond General Electric to General Motors spectrum, GE to GM. It's what Chomsky wrote about in the late 60s about here is the hawks and here are the doves. But the doves weren't really challenging the moral or imperial basis of the Vietnam War, they were saying, well, it's taken too long, let's get out. And that was the limit of acceptable debate. So, you know, it was fascinating for me to go on the inside and see the way the mainstream media would construct these center-right, these narrow debates. And, of course, the two people debating would be, you know, their veins are bulging in their neck. They're yelling at each other. But ultimately, politically, ideologically, it's a very, very, very narrow debate. And progressive and independent points of view are generally excluded.
Can you say, I noticed in your November 14th article for FAIR, you referred to Edward Herman as the master of dissent. Can you say more about the legacy you see Professor Herman leaving behind?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Matt Taibbi in Rolling Stone wrote a wonderful article. I mean, I think the legacy is question the mainstream media. Don't just question Fox News. Question the New York Times and NPR and Washington Post. Those are the main organs of the governing elite, more important even than Fox News, although there's obviously reason to critique Fox News. So I think Ed was someone who, you know, personally, he was so quiet and so mild-mannered. And when you would mic him up for a radio show or a public, you know, you had to keep telling him, put your mouth close to the mic, because he was so quiet. But his analysis was so angry. And, you know, his books had such moral indignation about how can the mainstream media, in a society where journalists do not get jailed or tortured, how can it be so cowardly in reporting on crimes committed by the U.S. government or its allies compared to the way Page One News is consumed by atrocities of our enemy states? And I think it was that moral indignation from the corporate liberal or imperial liberal elite. It was that moral indignation, I think, that people who have studied Ed, have met Ed Herman, that's the legacy, is to stand up to them. And it comes at personal cost. I mean, Edward Herman was victimized by a smear in the obituary of the New York Times after he died, where the New York Times obituary writer claimed that Manufacturing Consent, which came out in the late 80s, had undersold or understated the genocide in Rwanda and atrocities in Bosnia. Well, those events hadn't even happened until after the book came out. So, I mean, if you're talking about the kind of cost that to Edward Herman, you know, when you do the kind of rigorous critique of mainstream media, including the liberal media, then you really sort of get shunned, and the mainstream media and others in academia try to push you aside. And I think Ed Herman is sort of a model of bravery, that you stand up for this kind of analysis and this kind of critique, no matter what the personal shunning that goes on.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe and the homeland of the Red River Métis. This week, we are profiling the life and work of media critic and activist Edward Herman. In that last interview, mention was made of Edward Herman's later work. In 2010, he, together with Chicago-based colleague David Peterson, wrote The Politics of Genocide. This volume posited that the term genocide has been weaponized and is used in instances when the U.S. empire feels the need to thwart development or movements that run counter to the domination of the ruling elite. In 2014, Herman and Peterson co-authored Enduring Lies, The Rwandan Genocide in the Propaganda System 20 Years Later. They present the Tutsi-led Rwandan Patriotic Front as having initiated the killing spree 46 months in advance of the April 6, 1994 shootdown of the jet carrying Hutu President Juvenal Habyarimana, the act which, according to the standard account, triggered the infamous killing spree that would follow over the next 100 days.
This depiction of events has placed Herman at odds with prominent commentators on the subject, including Gerald Kaplan and George Monbiot. Some journalists have chosen to embrace Herman and Peterson's research and conclusions. One of these is Ann Garrison, a writer and KPFA broadcaster. Garrison has interviewed Edward Herman several times. She regularly contributes also to Black Agenda Report, Black Star News, Digital Journal, Pambazooka News, Counterpunch, and Global Research, among other media outlets. Ann Garrison began corresponding with Edward Herman in 2010. Here she is in a recent conversation with Global Research, relaying her perspective on the man and his work. I'm wondering what he was able to share with you and what you could convey with regard to this idea of genocide inflation as an instrument of U.S. imperial policy.
The seriousness, the gravity, and in some cases, most likely the numbers of U.S. allies who are massacred are inflated, and those who are either U.S. enemies or unimportant, whose deaths are unimportant to the U.S. foreign policy agenda, don't receive media attention or attention from public officials. And the Democratic Republic of the Congo is one of the most glaring examples. Millions of people have died since Rwanda and Uganda invaded the Democratic Republic of the Congo in 1996 and then again in 1998. And since they've carried on an ongoing de facto occupation in many parts of the country, millions of people have died, and the only scientific epidemiological estimate was done by the International Rescue Committee, which estimated that 5.4 million people had died between 2000 and 2007. And many of those had died of displacement. They died of hunger, disease, or other hardship after being driven from their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is ongoing. Recently, the UN gave the Democratic Republic of the Congo a level 3 emergency rating, meaning it's one of the worst in the world, along with Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Mm. Oh, and it receives very little press. And in fact, at the time that this was going on, the Save Darfur Committee had
Sudan
come into being. It was, I think that was in 2004, because it was a year after the beginning of the Iraq War. I think you told me you had a clip of a conversation that I had with Ed about that argument that the U.S. and or some assortment of Western forces should go into Sudan because of their
mm-hmm.
failure in
yes.
Rwanda.
Yeah.
I could hear the pain in his voice when he said, no, we shouldn't intervene anywhere. We have such dirty hands.
Maybe we'll just have a listen to it right now.
We have such dirty hands. We're intervening all over the world now. We're the great aggressor nation of the world, and we're using the NATO as our agent. Why can't we just leave people alone? These Sudanese can settle their own affairs. They don't need us. And if we take Rwanda and the Congo as an illustration, the United States intervention there has involved the death of millions of people. And now with Rwanda, we have a minority dictatorship again. So the whole effect of the U.S. interventions there, not just standing by, but interventions, has been the death of millions.
Okay, so that's Edward Herman from a conversation he had with you on this question of humanitarian intervention in Sudan. Well, not a very big fan of this humanitarian intervention responsibility to protect doctrine, was he?
Not in the least. And that's one thing I've been thinking about since we lost him, because he said, as in that clip, he said, no, I don't think we should intervene anywhere. We have such dirty hands. And on many occasions he said, this is never done with any real humanitarian intentions. It's always politically agendized, or at least by the U.S. and its allies. If anyone can think of a contrary case, I'd like to know what it is, and I know that he didn't cite one. And, you know, in that quote he said, the Sudanese will figure out their own problems. Why can't we just leave people alone? So, you know, he was saying that bad things are going to happen. I mean, bad things are going to happen. But peoples do have to work out their own problems. And we've got plenty of them here. No one's intervening to clean up the water in Flint or do anything about the horrific conditions in the prison gulag with 2.3 million U.S. prisoners, the greatest per capita in the world, and one in every 110 Americans. So Paul Jay asked him, on the Real News, Paul Jay asked him, well, what if one of our allies started slaughtering some of its own population, like Saudi Arabia? Would you favor an intervention in that case? And he still said no, because we don't do that. That's not what the U.S. does. It's absolutely unrealistic to imagine any sort of humanitarian intervention. And he was also always careful to point out that the UN Charter authorized military intervention in a sovereign member nation only after the UN Security Council had agreed that it was called for and organized the response.
And could you comment on what appears to be a kind of a shunning from elements of the left, largely apparently in response to this his critique of the depictions of what happened in Rwanda and Srebrenica as genocides?
It's astonished me how much everyone, most everyone on the left, has bought the standard model of the Rwandan genocide. It's so institutionalized that it's very difficult to challenge. And as Ed and David wrote in Enduring Lies, to be called a genocide denier is to be consigned to the lowliest strata of society with mother murderers and sex offenders and whatever else have you, extreme sociopaths. There's actually one exchange that's amusing regarding this that I'd recommend. George Monbiot of The Guardian, he started denouncing Ed and David Peterson, his co-author, about the politics of genocide. And Noam Chomsky had written the introduction to that book. So after starting his attack on Ed and David Peterson, he wrote to Noam Chomsky and asked him, how could you write this introduction to this book written by these genocide deniers? And Chomsky wrote back and told him that he did not see it that way and explained why he had written the introduction to the book, and he shared some of his own thoughts about it. And Monbiot wrote back with the same demand again. And this exchange went on, I can't remember how many times, but it went back and back, back and forth and back and forth until Chomsky finally said, look, I've had it with you. And then George Monbiot said, oh, my God, my idol, Noam Chomsky has been targeted. Can't believe it. He associates with genocide deniers. The And I was...
Sounds like it's just a non sequitur for some people.
Well, it's supposed to be a conversation closer. Yeah. You're a genocide denier. And if, say, on social media, any kind of discussion of a more complex story, as I said, a story which includes the four-year war that led to the massacres, and the inclusion of Hutu victims and Tutsi perpetrators, immediately I'm called the genocide denier, or anyone else who attempts such a conversation is as well. And that's just supposed to be the end of it. Ed did not let it bother him. He always stuck to his guns, and the people who called him and David Peterson and anyone else the genocide denier were quite obviously absolutists who thought that they had the one truth, and it was not even to be discussed.
In your last conversation, your last recorded conversation with Edward Herman, he had some interesting comments about the 2016 election and how he differed from his revered co-author and colleague Noam Chomsky in terms of voting for the Green presidential candidate Jill Stein rather than Hillary Clinton, who is perceived to be the lesser evil in that contest. What does that admission tell you about the man and his approach to politics and activism?
Well, it's another example in which it was so very close to mine. And I really appreciated his willingness to do that, to go public with that disagreement. It was not a bitter disagreement in any way. It was just, you know, a matter-of-fact disagreement. He said that he had always believed in Kant's categorical imperative, meaning that you should do what you would like to see generalized.
Uh-huh.
So if he wanted, he would have liked to have seen U.S. voters elect Jill Stein and Najami Baraka, even though only 1% did, and we knew we couldn't hope for much more than that year. And one of the other important things he said about that was that he thought it was important for the Greens, who don't have the money to run candidates in all the local and state elections all over the country, or to run a lot of candidates for Congress, it was important for them to articulate opposition to war and militarism, because that was the argument that was absent in the public discourse.
And it seems like his Ed Herman's last article had to do with the deconstruction of the New York Times as in sort of an ongoing theme in his work, as a you know, sort of that major talking about the New York Times as being basically a purveyor of these propagandistic myths. I wonder if you had a comment about it that you wanted to share.
I just want to read the first paragraph. He said, "It has been amusing to watch the New York Times and other mainstream media outlets express their dismay over the rise and spread of, quote, fake news, unquote. These publications take it as an obvious truth that what they provide is straightforward, unbiased, fact-based reporting. They do offer such news, but they also provide a steady flow of their own varied forms of fake news, often by disseminating false or misleading information supplied to them by the national security state, other branches of government, and sites of corporate power." And this is more relevant every day. This morning I saw that a major newspaper was announcing its plan to cooperate with some kind of newly formed trust and with Facebook, Twitter, and Google to combat fake news. And their statement was, found was basically a restatement of that paragraph I just read. They were saying, we take it as an obvious truth that what we provide is straightforward, unbiased, fact-based reporting.
Do you have a fond memory of Professor Herman, whether it was during an interview or a phone conversation or any other interaction that really stands out for you in retrospect?
Absolutely. I met Ed in 2010 because of his book, The Politics of Genocide. And the next year, NATO started bombing Libya in the name of stopping genocide. And he told me that he felt like he was being run over by a herd of water buffalo. He was such a wonderful person, kind, generous, modest, ironic. Ed lived the social ideals that he expressed. And you can, I don't know how anyone could have ever said there was anything inconsistent between his social ideals and the way that he treated other people, which was just a wonderfully respectful, cooperative, playful, often people we admire a great deal for their talent or intellect are not the greatest people in their actual interactions with others, but Ed was the opposite.
That was noted broadcaster and writer Ann Garrison. Edward Herman was both an inspiration and a promoter of groups seeking to overcome media censorship. One such group was Project Censored, the media research project headquartered out of Sonoma State University in California, which publishes an annual list of the most censored stories of the previous year. Mickey Huff is its current director and co-host with Peter Phillips of the Project Censored show, broadcast out of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. Huff wrote a reverent commentary about Edward Herman, which appeared on the Project Censored website. Huff related that Edward Herman had updated the propaganda model presented in Manufacturing Consent in a special essay appearing in the recently released Censored 2018.
Clearly, when that book came out in 1988, it really gave theoretical framework to what a lot of media scholars were already, you know, thinking about, or what they were already, you know, really wondering in terms of what shaped the news. Project Censored is a critical media literacy education organization, really. And we have long used the propaganda model in all of our media classes, social science classes, social classes, comms classes. Again, I mean, it's a classic theoretical framework to deconstruct and understand media propaganda.
Maybe tell us a little bit about some of the back and forth that was going on between you and Edward Herman as you were sorting out this or putting together this inclusion into the latest Censored book.
I had talked and worked with him a little bit years earlier before I even started with Project Censored at a project called RetroPoll. That was an organization that also used student research to conduct polls about how polls were actually used to shape public opinion, not really reflect them so much, and also looking at what public knowledge is on factual material and then asking questions about the same topics to see what the disconnect is in terms of, you know, why people believe certain things. And Ed Herman was actually one of our great supporters at RetroPoll. So that was my first, you know, encounters with him personally. You know, I wrote him now with Project Censored, and I said, hey, it's Mickey from Project Censored. You may not remember me, and, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, he wrote, you know, I said, this is a long shot, but we'd be honored if you had the time to give us your thoughts for our book about the 30th anniversary of the propaganda model that's coming up here. And, you know, I said, I understand you're busy. I know you have a lot going on, and but, you know, let us know. And he shot back right away and said, hey, you know, I've got two other pieces in the hopper that I'm working on. And one of them was the monthly review piece on Russia and fake news. He said, but if I can get a grip on that one, I'd be honored to write a chapter for you guys this year. And so we were pleasantly surprised and really happy about it, and we corresponded a little bit through the spring. And again, you know, Ed was in his early 90s, and just an amazing, really an amazing person. I mean, just so prolific and, you know, just really lucid. And we had a few phone calls during that period of time as well, you know, where he was like, I'm really working on this piece now, and the monthly review piece is out the door. And by the way, I encourage people to read that monthly review piece online. But nevertheless, we had some really great interactions where he would call and say, I get a little tired. I can work 4, 5, 6 hours a day, you know, and I got to kind of take a break. And so we had deadlines to meet as we got through June into June. And, you know, we just talked back and forth, but he was a perfectionist, really. He said, I really want to go and suss this out, or, you know, can I get one more pass at this draft? I have a couple things I needed to add to this. Gosh, what a humble person. I mean, a brilliant man, but he was just so down to earth and reasonable and dedicated. He gave us a great chapter that took on the challenges, you know, the challengers of the propaganda model over the years. And in my view, really resoundingly refuted many of the criticisms of the propaganda model over the years, and talked about the new age of the internet and the Facebook, Google, Microsoft algorithmic giants. And, you know, he really was kind of updating a lot of what was going on with the propaganda model. And through June, we finally got things wrapped up. Had a couple final phone calls and email passes during editing, and gosh, he was funny. What a great sense of humor. You know, even self-deprecating at times. You know, I literally laughed out loud at a couple of the quips that he made in some of our email exchanges about how, you know, he looked over something and was like, oh, how could I possibly have missed this or that? But, you know, it was just such an honor to, you know, get to talk with him. And I was greatly saddened of his recent passing. And I actually was just on the verge of reaching out to him. And, I don't believe he was doing any kind of interviews, but I was just on the way to, you know, get back in touch with him and thank him again and, you know, make sure he received copies of the book and all that. And he had passed away. But we're honored at Project Censored to have had the opportunity to work with Ed Herman and to publish what might be his last work. That's from my knowledge right now. I know Matt Taibbi wrote online at Rolling Stone that the monthly review piece was the final piece, as did a few others. But I know for a fact that this was the piece that he did after that one. And in fact, it's a 30-year retrospective. So seems like a fitting, certainly a, I wish it wasn't his last piece, but it's certainly a fitting final piece from such a brilliant and prolific author as Edward Herman.
Does he also get us into the whole realm of what we're seeing now, what they call a post-truth, fake news? We're moving to an era where the New York Times doesn't seem to have all-powerful control over what's being dispensed in the popular realm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, as the subtitle of our book suggests, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, the Rutgers media scholar Deepa Kumar did the intro or foreword for us this year and riffs all about the post-truth world and alternative facts and fake news. And we actually have a couple of chapters. Andy Roth and I talk about it. Nolan Higdon and I have a whole chapter on fake news and alternative facts and post-truth world. And, you know, I didn't guide Ed Herman in any way when he was writing this. But if you go through and look through, when he particularly gets to the part about the internet giants and surveillance marketing, you know, he goes on himself to say, and I'll read his own writing here just so you can see where he's going. He talks about how postings on Facebook have become a major news source for ordinary Facebook users and for other online services like Huffington Post and BuzzFeed and Facebook officials, partly in response to charges of allowing and passing along fake news, have been driven to manage the flow of news. And this has included developing and utilizing algorithms that can automatically prune out materials that violate moral or other standards. But Facebook officials have also engaged in negotiations with reputable news sources that seek access to the Facebook platform and want to participate in Facebook's rulemaking on access. And as Jonathan Taplin asks, how long before Facebook becomes the controlling force in the online journalism business? So you can see that Clearly, Ed Herman was thinking about this whole concept of fake news in its recent iteration. He was thinking about how this is the new conglomerated media ownership representation or manifestation, and was still rife with the conflicts from ads and elite sourcing and ideological proclivity and bias for whether it's neoliberalism or so-called open markets. And now what we see is Google is suppressing with its algorithms and searches. It's suppressing a lot of alternative narratives to official stories. In fact, Eric Schmidt publicly admitted that they were doing this. The propaganda model, like any theory, it doesn't perfectly explain everything, and nor did Herman or Chomsky ever say that it would or did. But it has explained quite a bit over the years, and I think that the propaganda model is ever as relevant now as it was 30 years ago. We just have to really turn our sights to sort of the new face of big media and online presence and algorithms as a new form of censorship.
Okay, well, Mickey Huff, unless there's anything else you'd like to share, an anecdote perhaps?
One thing that stands out is, in one of the email conversations we had, that I was trying to make sense of a particular note or a particular thing that had gone on there, and something he had written, and it was writing him for a clarification statement. And I had suspected that it was it was an error, and he just overlooked it. And he shot back right away with an email that was incredibly hilarious and in its self-deprecating way. Where he unleashed a few expletives on himself and said, "Oh, how could I possibly have missed that?" Or something. And I just thought to myself, just like, wow, you know, here's someone that's a nanogenarian and hasn't lost the art or skill set of sort of poking fun at himself. Again, he was just a really gracious human being, and I just feel really honored to have been able to have a few of the correspondence that we did. And, of course, at Project Censored, we're very honored to share this very important work and update on the propaganda model. So I certainly hope that more people will read it.
I've been speaking with Mickey Huff. He is director of Project Censored and co-host with Peter Phillips of the Project Censored show, broadcast out of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley.
Edward Herman passed away from bladder cancer at the age of 92 on November 11th, 2017. He leaves behind his widow and longtime friend Christine Abbott, a brother, Harris Herman, a stepdaughter, and 19 books and numerous articles and papers. Herman has contributed dozens of articles to Global Research since the site was created in 2001. To access those articles, please visit the URL www.globalresearch.ca/author/Edward-S-Herman. Edward Herman was also a piano player and reportedly fond of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Music this week was from Mozart's Piano Sonata No. 12 in F major, performed by Paavali Jumppanen, and Mozart's Sonata No. 13 in B flat major, performed by Brendan Kinsella. Many thanks this week to all our guests for taking the time to share their remembrances of Edward Herman. This program, along with other installments of the Global Research NewsHour, is available for download from the Global Research website. My name is Michael Welch. Thank you for joining us. Please come back next week for another installment of the Global Research NewsHour, and stay tuned for your next regularly scheduled program.